This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
I know what you're going to say, so save your breath.
No, I don't have a thing to say. Done the best you could. You really have the best you could. You can't expect to win them all. But I want to tell you something I kept to myself through these years. I was in the war myself, medical corps. I was on late duty one night when they brought in a badly wounded pilot from one of the raids. Could barely talk. He looked up at me and Doc, he said, "The odds were against us up there, but we went in anyway. I'm glad. Captain made the right decision." The pilot's name was George Zipp.
George Zipp said that?
The last thing he said to me, Doc, he said, "Sometime, the crew is up against it. The brakes are beating the boys. Tell them to get out there and give it all they've got. And win just one for the zipper." "I don't know where I'll be then, Doc," he said. "I won't smell too good, that's for sure."
"Excuse me, Doc. I've got a plane to land."
"I just want to tell you both, good luck. We're all counting on you."
It is 22 minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of November, the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming along and making part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. Thank you for joining us on this Monday. It is Monday, November 29th, 2010, and welcome to day 12. Draw near, and you might be amused and entertained. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Brought to you in part today by Sorrell's Vintages, in business since 1990 there at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne, right across from the Baghdad Theater, right next to Powell's Books. 3713 Southeast Hawthorne, right across from the Baghdad Theater. That is Sorrell's Vintages. It is 503-505-6964. If you'd like to join us today with your observations, comments, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, whatever it is that you have to share with not just me, not just Dawn, but with a whole world, with all of your brethren and sistren, with your fellow comrades, your travelers, your compatriots, all of those who walk alongside you on this long and winding road we call amusement. It's 503-505-6964. You can also text if you like to Skype. Our Skype name is Rick Emerson Show. You can email. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com if you'd like to engage with us in that fashion. You can also email Dawn. It's Dawn, D-A-W-N. Isn't that right, Dawn?
Yes, indeed.
D-A-W-N at rickemerson.com. The text box is open on the website as well. And all of that. It's all right there. It's all for the taking. It's laid out before you, spread on the table like a some sort of a communicative holiday feast. Except that makes it sound like the food is infected with something.
Like a cornucopia of communication options.
That's exactly what it is. Less like the Typhoid Mary thing, more like that she just said. It is the Rick Emerson program coming up today. We have your Job Watch, Cannibal Watch coming up today. Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas. We'll have a recap of last night. Did you finish Walking Dead?
I did indeed.
All right. So we got a recap of last night's episode of Walking Dead, Season 1, Episode 5. The penultimate? Yes.
Yes.
So the penultimate episode. So it's one more to go. So we got a recap of last night's Walking Dead, which I'm just going to say this. I'm saying for me, last night, best so far. Now, I know it's only we're only five episodes in. And I said that about, I think, episode three. Then a little bit of a dip last week, though. I feel like last night that they're back in fighting form. So we got that. We got Walking Dead. We got your Week in Geek coming up with Mr. Aaron Duran. Film critic Eric Snyder will join us in the studio later on. We'll talk about Harry Potter. But more importantly, we'll talk about do you know if he saw Burlesque?
No, he did. I don't know if he saw it over the weekend. I know that the screening, the reason I didn't see Burlesque, actually, the screening was the same time as the screening for the new Dwayne Johnson film.
Really? And he was just torn?
Well, no, he was actually, I believe, being paid to review the Dwayne Johnson film. And I decided if I couldn't see it with Eric Snyder sitting beside me, I didn't want to go see Burlesque.
He seems like a guy that might enjoy some fabulous crap.
He loves fabulous crap.
Excellent.
He's a good person to sit next to when things are crappy.
He also flew out of Salt Lake City Airport. Well, he flew into and out of Salt Lake, and they have the backscatter machine there, and he was actually flying on the day before Thanksgiving throughout the holidays. So we'll find out exactly what the... Here's the thing. So today is what? The 29th? 30 days has September. So tomorrow is the final day of November, yes? And then
yes.
Wednesday the 1st. So I don't know, like 2 weeks, 3 weeks from now? Something like that. I guess 2 weeks from now. I'll be gone for one show. So I guess Monday the 13th. Because so I get to fly to, you know, Salt Lake and then drive to... Not even just driving to Provo. I get to drive through Provo to a tiny little town on the outskirts of Provo. It's a town so small and uninteresting that it's like not even Provo wants to be associated with it. It's like you got to pass by Provo and then you just got to keep driving. You know, it's like when you go to Tannisbourne or something, you know, or like Hillsborough, where they just said, like, you go to Beaverton and then just don't ever stop. Just stay on the road like forever. So I get to go to Utah in a couple weeks, so I'm going to find out what I'm in for at the airport. What else? Coming up tomorrow, Mr. Zach Whedon be in the studio with us right there in that chair about 24 hours from now. Tomorrow,
when I bought that chair at the Goodwill bins over off McLaughlin. For $5.
Never did you anticipate.
Never imagined that Zach Whedon's butt would be resting on this chair.
I was just going to go the butt route. The buttocks of Zach Whedon. Gracing. Warming. Really sanctifying
And whoever gave this chair up and gave it to Goodwill.
Fools.
And it ended up in my hand. They never realized it would end up being the resting place of Zach Whedon's buttocks.
You know, it's like those people who gave Steve Jobs up for adoption, you know? You reconsider these things later on. You had no idea what they were going to go off and do. So that's 24 hours from today. So Mr. Zach Whedon, he's going to be doing several events as well. You can find out more about this by going to rickemerson.com. You go to rickemerson.com or facebook.com/rickemerson. You're going to be doing a special screening of Firefly Episode 14, Objects in Space, tomorrow night at the Hollywood Theater. And they're going to be doing a signing of Serenity, Shepherd's Tale. It's happening at the Hollywood Things from Another World. So you find out more about that at rickemerson.com. So that's all in the way. Hey, by the way, just apropos of nothing, I just wrote this down. This occurred to me last night. Somewhere in some parallel universe, there's the nerdiest guy in the world, and his name is Will Whedon.
Oh,
there you go. Will Whedon. I'm going to start a band called Will Whedon.
Will Whedon.
All right, awesome. I have nothing else. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Monday.
Well, the Obama administration is furious over those WikiLeaks things. And South Korea is calling off some military exercises because, you know, we're angry at them. And a fisherman is thought to perhaps be drowned in the Willamette.
Here's the thing. You started off today sounding a little bit like Heidi Topper, and now you're sort of you're still there, but it's like you're heading toward the on-ramp marked Margot Kidder. You know, just ever so, which is fine. I mean, there are worse things in the world than sounding like Margot Kidder. She's got quite a nice voice. I'm just saying I'll be interested to see how your voice transmogrifies itself. Now, is this because you're ill? Because you spent the night in maybe some smoke-filled room? You were shouting a lot? Have you just been vomiting all weekend?
I wasn't vomiting all weekend.
Oh, okay.
I was vomiting
You were vomiting
evening,
Thursday.
All evening into the night on Saturday.
This started Thursday night,
yeah.
Did it not? You were blaming it on bad... Was it bad pizza?
I thought it was old pizza. And I think
now?
What happened is... No, I think it's some kind of a... It was a virus that my husband gave me. I think whatever he was sick from for like a good week and a half, I think he gave me. Because, because I was kind of like peaked on Friday, but still functional. And then on Saturday, I was like, wow, I'm tired. Wow, I ache all over. And then in the evening and all the way till about 11 o'clock at night on Saturday, it was, again, the same thing, just horrible. So Sunday, yesterday, I had like no voice at all. Patrick would come in and say something to me, and I'd say, could you eat me some soup? And he'd be like, what? I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't talk any louder.
Awesome.
So I was a little concerned about it. So I spent all day yesterday sort of babying my voice and drinking like lemon ginger tea and doing all the things that you're supposed to do, because I knew, again, I had to come in here today and entertain the people.
That's right, because, you know, the comedy never sleeps. Entertainment never rests, Dawn.
My life has never been one where I had to actually be concerned about the quality.
You had a job you had to go to?
Well, no, that I had to worry about my voice.
Oh, that's true. I guess that's an interesting... I've been a writer
for years. I didn't really have to talk at all if I didn't want to.
You could probably go days without talking to people.
Yeah, and often did.
I'd never really considered that, I guess that maybe is... not unique, but it's certainly not the... It's abnormal to have a job where if you can't speak properly, then maybe you can't really do the gig.
Yeah.
I haven't really ever thought about that. Well, thank you for putting things in a new perspective for me, reframing my life in a different context. All right, well, so this is all true. So we got the headlines coming up. We got your Job Watch, Cannibal Watch, Joy of Christmas, Walking Dead recap, Week in Geek with Aaron Duran, Eric Snyder, Zach Whedon coming up tomorrow, by the way. And let's see, coming up, not tomorrow, but later on this week, in fact, this weekend, which is Saturday, December 4th, we're going to be paying a visit... We're going to be paying a visit to one of the happiest... It's probably a trademark phrase, the happiest place on Earth. It's one of the happier places on Earth. Really one of the most festive spots on the planet. Christmas Mountain Trees is one of our fine business partners. You can find out more about them at christmasmountaintrees.com. We are going to be there Saturday, and we will get you all the times and details on that. That'll be up at... there may, in fact, already be an embarrassing graphic of some kind posted, like at Facebook or on rickemerson.com. Because Cheryl, I saw what she was working on. And it was one of those things where she said, hey, by the way, I'm going to put it... Because the deal is, so Christmas Mountain Trees, you know, it's a Christmas tree farm, and it's a family farm, and it's quite a great place. And, they're great folks, Troy and Jennifer, who are the latest generation to run that place. And they said, hey, why don't you all come up and get some trees? And I said, by God, that sounds like a fantastic idea. So we're going to, go up and find a tree, probably one for the break room here as well. And then Cheryl said, hey, you know, we should tell everybody so the listeners can come up and they sort of, you know, see you. If they're going to get a tree, they can time it to be there in the same day, you know, whatever. And I said, boy, that's a swell idea. What a good head you've got on your shoulders. And then, like, 9 minutes later, in my inbox, and it's the kind of thing that I can't, and I'm not complaining about it, but I'm saying even if I wanted to, like, I can't, because it's like, you know, Cheryl does a whole lot. I mean, she really, yeah. I would say that she makes me look way more organized, than I really am. But now it's not just me. Now it's like the show. She makes the show look so much more organized and together and, like, with it. I mean, it bears no relation to reality whatsoever. And so it's like I can't kvetch about anything, but this graphic appears in my inbox, and she just says, hey, by the way, I'm going to post this up as soon as we confirm the date and the time for the Christmas tree trip. I'll go ahead and put this on the website. And it's just... And it's just this picture of me as an elf. And it's like the sort of thing you don't really ever anticipate existing. Like, you don't really...
Yeah.
You know, like, you don't really... You don't really figure that. I'm not dancing, but it is
like a big.
But it's like that. It's like it is. It's almost like a screen capture from like the. What is it, like Macy's or some damn place? They did the thing where it's like you're gyrating around like Alfonso Ribeiro, but you're an elf. Something very similar to that. Anyway, so just try to avert your eyes when you look. It's like watching porn. Just watch the part you care about. Just don't look at everything else. So the date and the time will be posted at rickemerson.com very soon, if not like already. And by the way, let me just say this. So speaking of my life and the whatever. I mean, so you spent your weekend, I don't know, and then presumably this morning, conserving your voice and trying to be whatever. So here's how my morning went. So this is, I don't even remember what I did this weekend, but I guess I did stuff. I guess I did things. I remember doing a lot of laundry, and it's like Lara had some friends over, so I was like cleaning the house at one point. I got a haircut. I think that was like the highlight of my evening last night. So I was like, I meant to watch Harry Potter, and I get a chance to do that, so I'm going to try to get that done in the next day or two. So, lots of things that I was going to get done. And so as I was coming in this morning, I thought, I was getting up and I was getting dressed, and I thought, well, I'm not going to have anything to talk about. I'll have no new tales of my own idiocy or inanity to relate. But I should have known that that wasn't the case. So I was taping Outlook Portland this morning. And let me just say first and foremost that it's not like I'm under any illusion that I'm like stylish or really talented like in any way, or that I have any sort of panache to me. But it's like every now and again, the universe just decides to remind you of just how useless you and unskilled you really are. And today was one of those days. I don't even know which half of what half of the story would you like to hear first. Would you like to hear the amazing display of talent that I saw this morning at Outlook Portland, or the retarded thing I did that brought it all into stark relief?
Well, I think you should tell tell about the amazing display of talent first, and then the retarded.
So I'll skip ahead. So I was at Outlook Portland this morning, and you know, that's in Beaverton, and then we were taping a little bit early today, taping at like 8 a.m. or whatever, and we were talking to a woman named Kim Howard from the Oregon Cultural Trust, and the Oregon Cultural Trust is it's an organization that helps to underwrite and fund any number of artistic endeavors in Portland, you know, and sometimes it's things like I think our good friends at Livewire, a little bit of funding from there. Yeah. They help to fund apparently the Pendleton Roundup of all things. They actually raise a lot of money for the Multnomah County Library System. People think that's all tax dollars, and it's not. A lot of that is private donations. And one of the things they fund is the Portland Youth Philharmonic. And the Portland Youth Philharmonic, and we talked a bit about this on Outlook Portland. This will air, I think, this coming Sunday. You know, it's just what it sounds like. It's a, you know, it's a young people who get together, and they, you know, they are, you know, they're in an orchestra, and they, you know, I guess there's four separate philharmonics. And so we decided to end the show with a little bit of a, you know, a little performance. So we had two students there, Jean and Christina, two young ladies who came and they performed. One of them was on the viola and the other was on the violin. And they're like, you know, they're like 12 or something. I mean, they're just like, you know, they're like one third my age. And I think they have more talent, like, in their navel lint than I will ever have in my body. Like, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's like you could just ensconce me in a monastery somewhere and do nothing but school me in the ways of classical musicianship. And I would never be... So Cheryl and I just sat there at Outlook Portland this morning just watching these teenage girls just play some of the most intricate and accomplished classical music I have ever witnessed in my entire life. I mean, and again, it's not like they're... How do I put this? It's not like they're in some special school for musical prodigies. I think they just go to, like, public school. And then, oh, by the way, they're also members of, like, the Portland Youth Philharmonic, and they're, like, freaking geniuses or something. You know, and it's like, they, of course, the people like that never really see anything amazing about it. Because after we're like, that's fantastic. You're a freak of nature. I mean, in the best way possible. You're amazing. And they went, oh, that's really, okay. Well, that's just a thing we learned to play. And they just, you know, and Cheryl and I are just sitting there looking at each other, and I just realized, you know, I just wasted my life. So that's what I saw when I got to Beaverton this morning for Outlook Portland. By contrast, here's what I did on the way to Outlook Portland. Okay. Now, I taped that show kind of early in the morning. And what I've learned is I can't really get much accomplished, like, in the early a.m. I mean, I can sort of feign that I'm awake, you know, but that's really all it is. It's just kind of pretending to be you know, up yeah. and at 'em. I, you know, it really is just method acting my way through my waking hours. So I set out everything the night before, you know, and then at the bare minimum is left to the next morning. Like, I set out my clothes, I iron my clothes, I put my computer, I pack my bag. So basically, I wake up, I put on my pants, I grab my stuff and I head out the door.
That's very smart and organized.
That's
of
what
you.
I'm saying. The only thing that I do between leaving the house and filming is I shave, do a little makeup, fix my hair, good to go. Because you know you can't really shave the night before because then you sleep and you get the growth and the whatever. So what I actually do though is I shave on the way to the studio. So I'll show you right now the razor, and you don't really have to see this to get the gag. But so. I'm going to Outlook Portland this morning. I'm driving on the 26 because I'm in Beaverton. So I got the razor here. I've got the razor in this hand, my right hand. I'm steering, you know. And by the way, I'm obeying all posted traffic laws and safety regulations. I'm shaving primarily at red lights and when I'm stuck in gridlock. You know, so it's not like I'm taking my life in my hands or anything. But the other thing as part of my morning ritual is I have the nice, crisp, refreshing glass of Viso. Mm-hmm. Why? Asleep. Gotta be awake. Gotta flood my system with chemicals and stimulants. It's really the only way that I can, make it to the studio without just falling into 1,000 pieces. So as I'm driving to Outlook Portland this morning, I have the Viso, and it's not in a can, it's not in a bottle. I've actually poured it into a glass over some ice because I got that whole, because things taste better when they're over ice, and so I got that whole ritual anyway. So I got the glass, and it's down in a cup holder by the gear shift in my car. So picture this. I'm in my car. I've got a glass of Viso over ice sitting in the cup holder by the gear shift. I have got in my right hand the razor.
Right.
I'm shaving at a red light. As the light turns green, I take the razor away from my face, and I get ready to put it back down on the seat because I want to drive responsibly.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what happens. In like a zillion to one shot, it's like one of those, I didn't even have to see the aftermath. I just knew in my gut that this had happened. I haven't even taken a drink of the Viso yet. It's just been poured over the ice. It's been cooling. It's been sitting in the little cup holder down by the gear shift. So after I shave, I take the razor away from my face, And there's this little button on the end here. This is the release button. You press this, and the top just springs open. Mm-hmm. I bump this on the steering wheel as I am taking it away from my face and getting ready to put it on the seat. I don't even know how I did that. Maybe it was adjusting the radio, or maybe I was, I don't know, I was like getting ready to turn the heater or something up, and I still had the thing in my hand. But I managed to hit the front of the Razor on the steering wheel. This pops open and then just dumps all of my ground-up facial hair into my Viso glass. And the thing is, it's like, it could have fallen anywhere, right? Like, it could have fallen into my lap. It could have fallen, into like the sort of ashtray. It could have fallen under the gear shift. It could have just not fallen out at all. It could have just, clung to the inside of the Razor through some sort of static electricity or, you know, magic or something. No, instead it just falls right out and just falls like, you know, like a sort of black and filthy snow directly out of the Razor.
God.
And then just like so many dead pepper moths just rains down into my Viso. And so then I'm driving along and I pick up the Viso glass and I'm just hoping against hope that what just appeared to happen didn't actually happen. And I pick up the glass and I look at it. And sure enough, it's like floating on top of the Viso is just like this thin scum of facial hair. Now you know what's coming next, of course.
Yeah.
Which is that I've had no caffeine. It's like, you know, it's like 7:15 in the morning.
So did you try to, like, actually remove
it?
Or did you just scoot it aside and try to zip around
it? Well, I'm driving. How am I going to remove it? And let me just ask you this. And with what mechanism would I do that?
I don't know. I mean,
and I'm not asking this in a rhetorical sense. I really am going to ask you now. I want you to picture, and it's just, you know, it's a glass. It's like a regular glass.
So you're on the freeway, though.
I mean, that's the thing is I'm getting ready to go on the 26 or whatever. So just picture yourself in this situation where you've got a glass, it's full nearly to the brim with Viso and ice, and then you've just managed to dump, I don't know, and the thing is, I don't clean my razor out all that often because you don't have to clean it out, you know, maybe every 3, 4, 5 shaves or something. So you got like 4 shaves worth of obliterated whiskers in there, you know, and then God knows what else, you know, whatever's in my face when I shave, and it just gets dumped into the glass of Viso, but again, you know, but it's like, you know what it's like to have the monkey on your back, Don. It's got to be fed. So, and yet I'm in the car. I'm driving. I'm on the highway. So I don't really have the opportunity to pull over. At best, I've got a chance to sort of slow down when I'm in gridlock or maybe at a red light or something. If I asked you how to proceed with that, how would you do it?
Well, as we've established, though, I am often kind of disgusting.
Right. Well,
I have
that makes two of us.
Two modes for snickety and completely disgusting.
Right.
So, honestly, my first reaction at that point would probably be to stick my finger in it and try and, like, sort of...
That's exactly what I did.
...scoot some of it away so I could sip around
that
it.
That is exactly what I did. That's the thing, is I didn't, like... Because my actual first thought was, like, do I have a straw? And then, of course, no. But what the hell would I have a straw? There's no reason. I mean, the only straw I would have conceivably had is one that, like, someone else had used. Because I don't really ever use straws for anything. Like, I don't drink a lot of, you know, like, I don't get, like, a lot of soda, like, fast food soda or whatever. So it's like, if there had been a straw, A, it would have been, on the floor of the car. Yeah. Or in the glove box. Or, like, you know, in the trunk. And then it's like you're drinking out of a trunk straw. You know, it's like, you don't want to do that, because that would be disgusting. So I don't have a straw, so I'm doing exactly what you... I'm hoping that through some combination of surface tension... And then, like, I don't know, like, secret magnetism or something, the whiskers will all sort of, like, cling together. And that if I move one, and I know that I'm horrifying everybody with this, but it's just like, look, it can't all just be sunshine and daisies, okay? It just can't be like me coming every day and said, like, I had a great morning where nothing went wrong. So I'm thinking that if I just move part of it over, that it's sort of like, you know, that it'll all just sort of like, it'll have like a sympathy connection and it'll all move at the same time.
Yeah. Well, you know, it works. It works sometimes for like oil spills.
That or swamp scum.
Yeah.
You know, or like the skin on a soup.
Yeah.
Maybe, or on a pudding.
So maybe, you know, yeah, I can.
Like, who hasn't had a bisque where you just peel off the top and throw it away? You know what I'm saying? So I kind of scoot the top over, and it's like this, and it's like I don't even want to think about the fact that it's probably sinking. It's like you know, it's raining down into the bottom of the cup. So I'm like, you know, and keep in mind, I'm in my car, and if somebody looked over, they would have just seen some guy with a glass full of some green beverage with, like, a blackened creme brulee-type coating on top that he was scooting. Like, how would you even have explained that? Like, if somebody looked over and said, what's that guy doing? There would have been no explanation.
Why aren't his hands on the steering wheel?
Seriously. Anyway, so it was exactly like an oil spill, except it was a hairy oil spill. And anyway, so yeah, I do. I take these three fingers, my middle three fingers, and I put them in, and I go like, as though you're trying to sort of like shoo the whiskers away to the other side of the glass. And I get them to move just enough so that they open up like maybe, like the surface area of the liquid is maybe like, I don't know, like an inch or something. You know, maybe an inch across and like half an inch into the glass. And I'm thinking, that's enough. I can fit my upper lip there. You know, and I can just, you know, just, you know. So then it's like, and then you're so disgusted with yourself. Like you can't believe that you are about to drink Vizo. This is, I guess, a ringing endorsement for Vizo because, you know, you can't believe you're about to drink Vizo out of a glass, you know, on the surface of which is like floating like a quarter inch of like facial hair. I mean, just saying it out loud, yeah. It just sounds insane and revolting, but also insane. Anyway, so I've scooted it back, and you know, I wait for the next time I'm at a red light. And I'm trying not to jostle it too much, and I think, all right, let's just do this, Emerson, and we'll get some life-giving caffeine into your system, and then we'll just, you know, let's move on. And it's like I tilt the thing back, but what I don't realize, of course, is like when you tilt it back, that's one thing. But then I'm just going and just sucking it in. And it's like, what did I think was going to happen? What did I imagine the outcome of sucking the... Because yeah. It's not like my lips are somehow just sucking the Vizo, like...
From underneath.
Yeah. It's like my lips... I'm not an anteater. So it's not like, yeah, I'm just getting the Vizo from, like, the bottom of the glass or something. No. Just sucking it right off the top. And so what do I immediately... Like, I just get a whole mouthful of wet Vizo scented whiskers. But to say that they're whiskers is not even like to... Because, I mean, I don't know if you use an electric shaver ever. They make those for ladies, I know. But,
yeah,
I mean, you've maybe... you've seen...
Yeah.
It's like whisker powder. You know what it is? It's like you were making Ovaltine out of hair. I mean, that's kind of what it is. So I just get a whole mouthful, you know, of whisker and Vizo and just my own shame and just self-loathing and horror. And it's like, there's just no, you know... And there's just no going back. And then, of course, and then I've just got the whole, like, because I kind of swallow part of it and I start to choke on part of it. But then you just got a whole mouthful of whisker. And then you realize there's nothing in the car with which you can rinse that out.
No.
You know what you can rinse it out with? Another glass of that. And I wasn't going to do that. So then I hadn't even gotten on the goddamn on-ramp. So then I've got another, like, 20 minutes of just sitting in traffic trying not to move my mouth at all, trying not to breathe or swallow or speak or just, you know, trying to keep my mouth kind of like, sort of open as though I'm trying to catch flies or something. Keeping my mouth like about 2 inches open the entire, because I don't want to close my mouth because I don't want anything to come into contact with anybody else because I don't want to have to think about the fact that the inside of my mouth is now covered in fur, basically.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, and then I get to Outlook Portland and, hey, Rick, how are you? Hi. You know, and just walking into the kitchen, and it's like there's no, you know, how's your morning? You know, how can I possibly explain that or share that with anybody else? I can tell you, because you know that I'm repellent and hideous. But it's not like I can tell the guest. And by the way, did I mention I'm speaking to somebody from the Oregon Cultural Trust? You know, where they're, you know, they're talking about art and sophistication and panache and raising one's standard of behavior and excellence and expecting only the finest things in life.
Teeth are coated with your own whiskers.
I've got a mouth filled with hair because I was drinking from a hair-filled glass while I was on the... I mean, there's no explaining that to anyone. And so then the day ended, you know, my morning anyway, ended with seeing these two, like... genius prodigy teenagers, you know, play like some like Chopin piece, you know, on the viola and the violin, like with more skill than I can do anything in my life. And I'm sitting there picking hair out of my teeth. You know, that really puts things in perspective. Jesus. I'm glad that I have...
I wonder if Carl Click has these problems.
No. No, he does not. I mean, no.
I can never imagine, like, say, Anderson Cooper, you know, going on the air with a mouthful of his own hair.
No, I mean, the thing is, I knew you would understand, though.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
I mean, it's like you haven't had probably this exact thing happen to you, but you've probably had similar things.
No, I had a thing this weekend because my throat, you know, with the voice and the throat and everything, so I grabbed the remains of this package I had of candied ginger that was sitting on the kitchen counter. and stuffed it in my bag and drove to Vancouver. And while I was sitting in Vancouver, I opened up the bag and pulled out a piece and ate it. And while I was chewing it, I looked down and discovered there were ants in the package.
Oh, wow.
And then just wondering if I had eaten an ant.
Wow.
And can you get damaged from eating an ant? And I'd been battling ants on my bookcase, like in my dining room, for like days. And I kept taking away everything they could possibly be after and couldn't figure out what they were after. And apparently they were going, they were scurrying up onto the counter and getting into this and then scurrying back to the bookcase because there were no ants on the counter where the stuff was. So there was no reason for me to think that that was it.
No, of course not.
And so then, so yeah, I'm sitting there and there weren't a lot of ants. There were only like three or four, but still there's ants.
Well, there's only three or four, I mean, left because God knows how many you ingested. They might have all been on that one piece of candy.
One piece of candied ginger and then I look down and there's an ant on my hand and I'm like, ah! So, yeah, and so I spent like the next 10 minutes wondering, like, I don't think you can get hurt from eating ants. I mean, in some cultures, they eat ants as a form of protein.
Yeah, but I mean,
they can't be bad for you.
But you want to do it intentionally. You don't want that sneaking up on you.
Yeah, you don't want to have that as a surprise.
Because what you don't want, here's what you don't want.
And then again, I felt like, God, what is wrong with my life that, like, I open a package and there's ants in it?
I mean, it's like, you know, you just feel sometimes like you're just barely at the walking upright stage, you know?
I mean, you've been to my home. I'm not, like,
you're a clean
some
person.
Kind of creepy hoarder person or anything.
You're not slovenly in any way.
But, yeah.
You know, no, that's, see, and that's, you know, and it's like, the thing with accidentally ingesting a mouthful of ants, which I have done, I did that when I was a kid one time, it's like I made the mistake of leaving, like, a sandwich on the ground or something, and then I'll eat it now. You know, and here's the thing that you're horrified of. It's a totally irrational fear, but for the rest of the day, you're afraid that while you're speaking with somebody in conversation, an ant will, like, crawl out of your nose or just, like, it'll be, like, hovering on your lip, and somebody will be like, Bob, you've got ants coming out of your mouth. And you, oh, pardon me, I'm so embarrassed. You have to brush them away
or something. Well, also, because after that happened and I found the ant on my hand, then I wondered if any of the ants, if there were, like, an ant or two that had crawled out into my bag while it was in my bag.
Yes.
So then I'm searching through the bag because then I'm thinking, of course, now the ant will, like, leave the
bag.
Laying eggs. And leaves, like, I'll come to the studio, and it'll get in the studio, and then there'll be ants everywhere, like ants.
You'll be one of those
magically, you know, reproduce like that.
You'll be like one of those people that accidentally brought fire ants or tarantulas from Colombia or something, like with like a banana shipment.
Yeah.
Somebody says, "Hey, wow, you guys are all class today. Well done." followed by, "Good Christ, it's like those people who drink their own urine." And you are actually drinking a glass of your own dead skin and hair. You are the most revolting person I have ever heard or heard of.
Oh, that's nice.
Okay. But by the way, that's targeted at me, by the way. So you can feel that at least you are not as revolting as some.
No, I accidentally ate an ant. I didn't deliberately drink my own
whiskers. That's the thing. Look, it was a judgment call. I mean, because otherwise it would have been, you don't want me in the row without caffeine. Because that's just begging for trouble.
Although I admit there was that moment where I was just going, oh, man, ants. And then I went, well, I mean, what kind of damage could they do if I eat another one that doesn't have an ant on it?
Brush them off.
And then I think to myself, I can't believe I'm actually thinking about,
oh, no. Well, that's like the whole.
And then I made it go away.
That's like the picking up, you know, the thing out of the trash if nobody sees it. Or like out of the trunk of your car or something, you know, where you just find, like, oh, it's a McDLT. No one saw me take it out of the back of the trunk, so it's like it was never there. Let's see. Well, we'll get to, in just one moment, Mr. Aaron Duran from geekinthecity.com. We'll have the Week in Geek. Let's get a couple of stories from Don Taylor at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
South Korea has called off plans to carry out artillery drills on the same island that came under attack by North Korea last week, officials said today, saying that the drills were prematurely announced before being cleared by military authorities. They added that the cancellation has nothing to do with last Tuesday's attack on Yeonpyeong Island, which left four people dead and 18 more wounded after South Korea attempted to conduct a similar military exercise. South Korea's president is warning that North Korea will face severe consequences if it launches another military attack across its southern border.
Wait, so who's warning who? South Korea's warning North Korea?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. They said that the U.S. is standing. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, says the U.S. is standing behind its ally, South Korea.
I'm sorry, is this Korea 1?
Yes.
All right, hold on a second. Let me just wait with the whole... there we go.
We continue to call on North Korea to cease its irresponsible actions against its neighbors, to fully abide by the terms of the armistice, and to adhere to its international obligations.
Because this is one of those things where, like, if they get attacked, if South Korea gets attacked, that we got to get our nuke on or something. Or we got to go, like, we got to defend them or something. Like with Taiwan, I think it's the same thing.
Something like that.
All right, okay.
Rice said that the U.S. is calling on North Korea to cease its irresponsible actions against South Korea.
We will continue to work with the international community to maintain peace and security in this region as we simultaneously confront the threat posed by North Korea's ongoing nuclear activities.
So this really is just one step above writing the strongly worded letter, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, come on, be a pal.
Well, even though South Korea did cancel their plans to carry out artillery drills, they did bring a nuclear-powered U.S. submarine and a South Korean destroyer near the island and held a bunch of flashy drills anyway, while President Lee Myung-bak delivered a speech about the shelling, saying, if the North commits any additional provocations against the South, we will make sure that it pays a dear price without fail. So they called off blowing anything up, but they did make sure that there were a couple of big ships near the island that North Korea shelled and went, look what we got.
Right. Sort of like it's kind of like when you just sort of like at a saloon, when you think the guy might be cheating at cards.
Yeah.
You don't shoot him. You just kind of take the gun out and you set it on the table. Sort of, it's your deal, Zeke, you know, and then, you know, and then the message is, it's implicit, as
exactly.
they say. Let's do one more here, and then we'll speak with Mr. Aaron Duran.
A man is facing assault and battery charges after deputies say he flailed his wounded arm around with the intention of spraying medical staff with his blood. Daryl Herbert Cockfer, 22.
Cockfer?
Cockfer.
Okay.
Or Cockfer. Mm-hmm. There is an E in the middle. Is charged with battery on a firefighter paramedic after medical staff told deputies he swung his bleeding right hand at a firefighter in Pascal County, Florida, last Wednesday.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida. Getting blood in his left eye along with all over his face and neck. Paramedics claim they were transporting Cockfer, who, by the way, there is a photograph of him that you can find.
Darby, sir, are you transporting Cockfer? Yes.
RickEverson.com/pictures.
Okay.
They were transporting Cockfer after he cut his arm on barbed wire while playing Manhunt, a hide-and-seek-type game, in his yard in Shady Hills, Florida. After transporting him to the hospital, Cockfer began flailing his arms around and wouldn't stop, despite orders from paramedics and nurses. One paramedic got blood in his eye and immediately retreated to wash it out.
Is he one of God's special people?
Well, deputies did note that Cockfer was under the influence of narcotics. He later tested positive for opiates, benzodiazepines, and marijuana.
He was playing Manhunt in his backyard, which involved getting tangled in barbed wire.
Apparently so.
Okay.
He told deputies he had no recollection of flailing his arms. Medical staff said he was uncooperative and combative. When he was told to stop flailing his arm, deputies were told Cockfer continued to swing his arm at a more frenzied pace. So,
You know, that's I will say this, whatever stressors that might occasionally come with working in the broadcasting, whether it's television or terrestrial broadcasting or online broadcasting in this brave new world, here's a danger we don't face. The idea that a guy is going to use like a stool or something, as a weapon against you. Because, you know, my wife deals with that, you know, or she'd like not all the time, but it's like, you know, you got to figure that crazy guys come in and it's like, you know, any port in a storm. So, hey, I'll just fling my urine at you, you know, and that's blessedly, I think I can count on the zero fingers the number of times that that's ever happened.
No, me either.
Damn.
The photograph of the guy, if you see his...
Does he look like a blood splinger?
Actually looks a little bit like if Ethan Hawke was on a whole lot of drugs.
All right, hold on a second. Let me just... this is at rickemerson.com/pictures. You look at the visual aid section. And I have to change the date on that, but it's the, I guess it probably says the most recent. But he looks, so it's like a sort of like a drugged up Ethan Hawke, you're saying?
Kind of.
All right. It's the Rick Emerson Radio program still to come. We got your Job Watch, Cannibal Watch, Joy of Christmas. Mr. Eric Snyder will join us here in just a skosh. We'll recap last night's episode of Walking Dead as well. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio program from geekinthecity.com, Mr. Aaron Duran with the Week in Geek. Hello, sir. How are you on this fine Monday?
Well, I was good till I tuned into the show, and it was all hair talk.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
Thanks for that, jackass.
All right, I forgot. Did you know that Aaron has a whole hair thing?
You have mentioned that, yes.
I'm sorry. No, I swear to God. Now, that was really honestly not, that was not intentional. I guess it was just a little unexpected bonus for me. I forgot that you had a thing. Now, at the risk of sounding like I'm trying to just exacerbate this, is it...
Yeah.
Is it that you have a thing about... you have a sensitivity toward stories involving hair just in the mouth or, like, in general? For example, like, if you see a guy and he's just got, like, he's like one of those Guinness Book of World Records guys, you know, with, like, the long fingernails, but he's got, like, hair to his feet or something. Like, does that weird you out?
No, that's fine because it's still connected. That's the break. That's the deviating point in my brain.
What if a guy just had a big bundle of hair that he was collecting, keeping under his pillow at night?
Yeah, that's repellent. He should be taken out back, shot, and everything burned.
So if you it's detached hair. Okay, let me ask you this because I'm fascinated by this. What if if it's a guy, he has the really long hair, maybe not Guinness long, but it's like, you know, it's like it's like Molly Hatchet long. It's Frank Frazetta long. And
good reference there with the Frazetta.
That's what I do. And maybe he's he's riding his bicycle American Flyers style, and maybe the hair stays attached, but he kind of, you know, gets a little bit stuck in his mouth. Now, but the hair is still attached to his head. Does it revolt you?
No, totally fine. When I had long hair, that used to happen to me. It was like, oh, that's annoying. And then you spit it out and you carry on with your day.
Okay, but hair that
I used to have really long hair.
Hair that is detached and then either ends up in your mouth or somewhere else, or that is like, you know, ends up somewhere that it shouldn't normally be. That's where the dividing line is for you.
Yeah.
All right. That's so like, this would be like that. This would be like that time when we were at Denny's. And, and it was somebody, I forget who, at the table, ended up with, like, the long hair that was, I think it was actually so long it was trailing halfway down the person's throat.
Ew. Ew.
Yeah, that, I think I'd be done eating.
Okay.
That was
just,
it.
Just checking. All right. What is happening in the world of geekdom, sir?
Oh, boy. Now I got to recover. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's what I do.
Well, I mean, the big thing locally, everyone's been talking about the past few days, is the Zach Whedon sighting at the Hollywood Theater and Hollywood Things on the World, which is tomorrow evening. So that's 6:30 at the Hollywood Theater, and then 8:30 over at the Hollywood Things on the World. They're going to actually do the signing with Zach Whedon and artist Chris Somney for Serenity the Shepherd's Tale. So that's really kind of the big go-to event this week in Portland. So that's going to be all kinds of righteous.
And because the Serenity of the Shepherd's Tale, it's a graphic novel, and this is like the backstory for Shepherd Book, right? This is because he's such an enigma, you know, in the series and then even in the movie. But this kind of explains, and they make so many just oblique references to whatever he was beforehand, where he came from, and why he seems to know some of the things he knows. And there was that whole business where it's like he was known to the Alliance, you know, and they knew who he was because he had like the identification card or whatever on him. So Shepherd's Tale though addresses some of those things.
Yeah, and the Shepherd's Tale. It's a pretty thick graphic novel also. It's a pretty righteous-looking book. Not to give away – even the movie's a couple years old now. The book opens with him dying, you know, so spoilers there. I mean, anyone who watched Serenity knows what happens to Shepherd Book, so.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, in classic Whedon style, he kills everything that we love.
Right, of course. Well, that's it. That's the whole thing is just Joss Whedon one time said that he doesn't give you what you want. He gives you what you need. And that usually involves making you love somebody and then killing them in some horrific, unexpected fashion. Does this start – so does this lead up – it starts with his death and then it jumps back presumably and then works forward. So it's a little bit – so it's like a prequel basically in graphic novel form.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it starts with him dying and then it tells his whole – I mean, even goes all the way back to like his childhood, which – so I mean it's a pretty cool book. It's really well done.
What is speaking? So this is tomorrow. So Zach Whedon's going to be at the Hollywood Theater. They're going to be showing Firefly, Objects in Space, 6:30, and then he's going to be doing the signing at Hollywood Things from Another World location, I believe, at 8:00. I wanted to ask you, speaking of all things Whedon-esque, so what is the deal with them rebooting the Buffy franchise? Are they doing that with a series or with the movie or both?
I think it's going to be the movie. And it was one of those things where, like, Joss Whedon found out about it, you know, flipping through Vanity Fair.
Of course.
You know, flipping through Variety. It was like, oh, well, okay. Because I don't know how it works. I think he owns basically the television version, but not the movie version of Buffy.
And so this is the thing where they're going to be because it was originally a film and then it was made into a television series, and they're going to be going back and starting – just going back to the beginning, starting it again, making a different film version. And they, didn't bother to ask him, like, his input or his permission. He just – you know, it was like the whole thing of, you know, just finding out that you've been dropped from your record label by paging through Rolling Stone or something.
Yeah, totally. Although he was pretty cool about it. When someone asked him about it, when he gave the answer, he's like, well, you know, it's tough out there, you know, in Hollywood to do anything original. He's like, I mean, we can't all be me doing original work, you know, what with me doing the Avengers that I created all on myself, on my own.
And Wonder Woman, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, he kind of, you know, he laughed about it too. But I think it's going to be more, but I don't think he's going to get residuals out of it either. So that's the bittersweet pill.
What else is going on in the world of nerdality?
Something right now, it may not happen for about a year, but there are rumors going around
that Microsoft, specifically through the Xbox 360, is going to be talking to major cable television providers and offering shows by subscription on Xbox.
How is that? In other words, you would get like first run shows that appear.
Yeah, basically, you would even cable television become even more irrelevant in terms of like, you know, getting content into your television. Say, you know, you want to get like The Walking Dead, but you don't want to buy the expanded cable package.
Right.
You would buy a season of Walking Dead.
So it's not just like getting an a la carte channel. It's just like getting an a la carte feed of one particular program.
Yeah, you would buy shows.
Wow.
And so far the rumor is that Microsoft is looking into that because they want to be ready to compete with Google TV when that launches. It has the complete nationwide launch. They want to be able to stand toe-to-toe, you know, with Google. They don't get caught with their pants down this time, which is what's happened on a couple of, you know, Microsoft products on that.
Well, because Apple TV is out there too, and I think Apple TV is like in its second or third iteration, and our friend Siegfried actually picked it up and said that, and he just raved about it. He said that, you know, the content there's not like voluminous content yet, but that the interface and, you know, just everything about it is so great that once the content is ready and it's basically, you know, it's like all the Apple stuff in the early days. You know, once the content is actually there, it's like the device itself is so awesome, you know, that everybody's going to want one. So that clearly is where, you know, and Gates, I was actually just talking to somebody about this morning, that everybody's trying to create the one device that is the central point for all of your home computing and entertainment. Everybody's trying to be, because like, you know, 10, 12 years ago, it was all about everybody wanted to be the web portal, you know, the one website you went to that served all your needs.
Right.
And nobody really cares about being the web portal anymore. Everybody wants to be the actual piece of hardware in your home that is the portal to the rest of the world for your entertainment.
Yeah, and I think Microsoft is starting to poise, is trying to get the Xbox to be that. I mean, I know some people that own an Xbox and they use it for gaming maybe a third of the time. The rest of the time, it's, you know, you can stream ESPN now. You know, you've got Netflix coming through your Xbox. In fact, I forgot who just did a study, but about 20% of all the bandwidth used every evening in the United States is for Netflix streaming.
Wow. I mean, it's what's between that and like torrent stuff. So that, I mean, that, and
totally.
My wife who power loaded, I think, like 6 seasons of Weeds via the Xbox in like a week and a half or something. So. Let's see. One before we wrap all this up. I got a few people that had emailed me. They asked for the update on the Geek in the City comic, La Bahia. And so I know that you are heading toward the printing stage right now, so people can track all the progress of that at geekinthecity.com. Yes.
Yes, and you can also go to. It's easier to update, so we started a Facebook page. If you just go to facebook.com/geekinthecitycomics, you can keep pretty much real time updates. Whenever I learn information about, you know, the printing stages of the comic or distribution or how you can get a copy if you don't live in Portland, always check out geekinthecity.com. But the Facebook page for Geek in the City Comics, you know, I can update from my phone. So
excellent.
That's also a good place to get all the information on there.
Fantastic. Mr. Aaron Duran with The Week in Geek. Mr. Aaron Duran of geekinthecity.com. All right. Have a fantastic day, sir.
And to you. Thank you.
All right. There you go. I resisted the urge to call him Hair Duran. All right. Here is Don Taylor.
Well, let's do our Cannibal Watch.
Excellent. Here is your Cannibal Watch for, what is today, Monday? Here's your Cannibal Watch from Monday, right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Excelente. Here is Don Taylor with your Cannibal Watch.
Russian police have arrested 3 vagrants suspected of eating a 25-year-old man they butchered and of selling other body parts to a local kebab house.
Okay.
Suspicions were raised when dismembered parts of a human body were found near a bus stop in the outskirts of the Russian city of Perm.
Kebab's your uncle.
720 miles east of Moscow. 3 homeless men with previous criminal records were arrested on suspicion of setting upon an enemy with knives and a hammer.
By the way, nothing conjures up the horrific image of an untimely and painful death than the phrase set upon.
Yes.
You know what I mean? That's like besieged or something. Swarmed.
Well, after setting upon him with knives and a hammer, they then chopped up his corpse to eat it, local investigators said in a statement. The prosecutor general's main investigative unit for the Perm region said, after carrying out the crime, the corpse was divided up, part was eaten, and part was sold to a kiosk selling kebabs and pies. The discovery of the body was made on Friday in a forested area of the city. Investigators have not revealed if the body parts were sold to customers of the kebab. Kiosk.
I would imagine that they'll try to keep that somewhat under wraps. Oh, my God. Jesus. This, you know, but it, I mean, there's like so many. And where is this?
In Russia.
I mean, are they? Is there any specificity as to the location?
Because you know, everybody. Well, 720 miles east of Moscow, and they said that the body was found near a bus stop in a forested area of the city.
Because I'm just wondering. So, I mean, at least they said that, because otherwise, it's everybody at every kebab house in all of Russia is just going like, you know, you think your food poisoning felt bad. I mean, that implies, first of all, this is like the stories about the guys who go and they like dig up some hot chick that, you know, that they saw her obituary picture and thought, well, she can't say no now, you know, or what. It's like the idea that one guy would do that is cracked enough, but then he could like convince a couple other guys. Like I have some friends who, you know, like, if you know, you, like I've seen them get really drunk, but it's like at no point I'm able to go like, hey, Larry, you got a shovel? Yeah, how about you? You know, Bob, shovel? There's this hot chick they just buried. I mean, I can't imagine. Like, what, you must travel in really specific circles. So this is the same thing where it's like you got to convince a whole bunch of guys not only to kill somebody, not only to kill him and then eat him, but then to kill him and eat him and then just to, like, go part him out like an old Impala at a kebab hut.
There is something to be said for sort of the efficiency, you know, of what they're doing. Right. It's like, first of all, this guy's an enemy, so they want to kill him anyway. Then it's like they're homeless, so they're probably very hungry. They say, well, now we have all of this meat. Let's eat the guy. But they have more meat than they actually need. So it's like, how about we cut it up and we sell it to the kebab house?
It's like a waste not, want not kind
of a thing. There is sort of a reuse, recycle kind of a thing going on there.
This is like how the
sort of impressive.
This is like how the Indians would use every part of the, I don't know.
Buffalo.
I was going to say that, or, you know, a whale or whatever. Yeah. You know, this is just, you know, because you can find a use for everything. But then, like the kebab place, look, I know it's Russia and all, but I mean,
yeah, just buying meat from homeless guys.
Seriously, I mean, the thing is, here's the horrible thing, or not, I just don't even know anymore. This is such a weird funhouse mirror of a story. It probably never occurred to the kebab hut guy. And I mean, what a sad way to end your life. I mean, it's like, you know, you face trials and travails and ups and downs, and you have love and loss, and you know, you struggle through school and romance and your career, and you're battling all kinds of adversaries, you know, both literal and figurative, and having, you know, trying to find out the nature of yourself, and then you just end up being sold out of a kebab hut. I mean, what the hell is life even about anyway? Life is effed.
But also, the kebab hub guy had to know there was something sketchy about the meat. Because, you know, homeless guys come up to you and say, we got a bunch of meat. Unless one of those homeless guys in a previous iteration was a butcher, it's not like they're, you know, presenting this meat like nicely sliced steaks.
What's the best?
It's going to be a mess.
What's the best case scenario if you're the kebab hut guy?
You're thinking they killed a dog.
That's exactly. Okay, you got to get out of my head because you're freaking me out today, because every single thing I go to, you're like a step ahead of me today. That's exactly what I was going to say. And like, I'm not going to say it's horrible. I mean, I guess that's maybe a cultural thing. But I mean, still, that's less about the fact that it's a dog, because again, that's subjective. Then it's like homeless guys with their like filthy, you know, like homeless hands going like, would you like some meat then? And you know, and it's like they got maybe
with,
a newspaper.
With some kind of story that may or may not. Yeah.
Like what? Maybe they've wrapped it in bark. I mean, if you're lucky, they go, here you go, some meat from an alley. And the guy goes, well, okay. And I mean, did he even buy it from them? Or was it just like, were they just trying to get rid of it? And they go, would you like meat? And he went, yes, I would. I can never have enough meat here.
Well, it said they actually sold some of the body parts. And it actually says selling body parts to the kebab house. So
not even necessarily meat, but like a foot.
I don't know. It might, it could have been like a leg, a whole leg or something. Yeah.
I wonder if it was like some sort of ongoing deal. You know what I mean? Like if it was sort of a, you know, it's like when you, like when the, you know, when
yeah,
the
if you ever kill a guy. I'm just saying.
Yeah, like if you ever, or like when the kingpin gives the street dealer, you know, gives him like half a key and says, look, if you move that, you come back and I'll give you three next time. You know, so like you get crawl, walk, run. They're starting with, you know, with one body, and then they figure maybe they can get their wholesale on or something if it really works. I went to a shrink one time, and it's like, I had this shrink tell me, he was talking about me and my various neuroses or whatever, and I was talking about something or other, and he said, people like you, which should have been my first indication, by the way, that it was going to be the wrong shrink for me, because he was immediately like, because I like to think that I'm a special snowflake, and he was immediately lumping me in with all the other snowflakes that are crazy, and he said, here's the thing about people like you, he said, you just go through your whole life just thinking that the world is effed and that everything is, you know, everything sucks, And, you know, and sometimes you think to yourself, well, he's right. You know, really, I'm just viewing the glass as, like, empty and broken and, you know, dirty and sold out of a kebab hut. You know, that's no way for anyone. I don't even care if you're even a Russian. That's no way to end your life. Being put, like, on pita bread and sold to a school child or something. You know what I mean? Some guy going off to, like, a box-making factory and he's drunk on hydraulic fluid. He drained out of the neighbor's van. You know, and then he gets you on a taco on his way to the, you know, on his way to the factory. Jesus. I mean, that's the thing where really just that the phrase like death doing you a favor, that with the sweet embrace of death could not have come for a better guy than that. Because, I mean, otherwise you're just, you know, you're just sitting there just wondering about, you know, the eternal verities. Is it like there's a guy's ladling like kebab sauce over your eyeballs? Jesus. Seriously, the world is just this world is just fundamentally just, I mean, we are just a wreck. We're lousing up the entire joint, really, in like ways that nobody, I think, ever conceived or imagined.
If only there was something happy and joyful to think of.
All right. I don't know where you're going with that, but
I got nothing. I just feel like I need to try and like throw you a rope and pull you back up from the abyss.
I just, you know, look.
I really didn't expect you to like, I don't know, personally relate to the story on such a deep level.
I'm not relating to the story as such. I'm just saying, like, you know, there are times when you think
you put yourself in the guy's position and you are imagining yourself being sold at a kebab hut.
Well, seriously, I mean, it's like we do. Okay, look, here's another example of what I'm talking about. Then we'll take a break. We'll come back. Mr. Eric Snyder will join us. Talk about Mormons groping your penis at a Salt Lake airport, you know, maybe or not. I mean, who knows? So he traveled on Thanksgiving, so we'll figure out exactly what happened there. Don't forget, coming up later on, we got your—you might still be a little too cheery. We got your Job Watch coming up, and Rick Emerson's, quote, joy, end quote, of Christmas. Also, Walking Dead. It's really just a cavalcade of fun.
And a snuff watch.
It's all—really?
So, yeah. So it's
oh,
just,
that's right. And yeah. Again, it's nothing but whimsy. But what was I saying? Well, it's like this. You know, so I don't think I've ever brought this to work. But, you know, I got this, like, skull at home. You know, like an actual, like, a human skull. Yeah. His name is George, apparently. Given to me by a listener because his wife, he sensed that his wife was about to throw it away. So he, like, you know, it's like smuggling the Von Trapps or whatever out of, you know, out of Austria or something. So he, like, gave me the skull. He's like, I don't want my wife to throw it. I want it to go to somebody who would appreciate it. And now, little man, I give the skull to you. So he gave me the skull.
I would like to suggest, by the way, if you're the kind of person who actually has a human skull, you should not be married to someone in the first place that would throw your skull away.
It seems like that is really, there's two kinds of people in the world in that sense. There's people who really want to, they understand why the skull needs to stay. People who think the skull ought to go.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, and never the twain shall meet.
And you ought to have figured that out before you got married, because obviously I'm thinking there are some deep, deep problems in
Seriously.
This relationship if she's that misunderstanding.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, there's Blur, there's Oasis, there's Jeopardy, there's Wheel, there's, you know, there's pineapple on your pizza, there's naan. Skull, no skull. It's like my Sharon Tate, you know, the piece of my Sharon Tate fireplace. You know, I'm not saying like Lara shows it off to her friends when they come over. She actually closes the door to the office so they can't see anything in there. You know, but she doesn't say like, you got to get rid of that. So I get this skull, you know, and he's like, I don't know, some like late teens, early 20s British youth from 40s or 50s, I guess. They found that out at some point. And it's like, you know, look, it's not like I don't give it a good home. I like to think that I do and that I, you know, I look at it fondly every now and again and I smile and I say, hello, George, and then I go back to writing or whatever. But it's like, that guy didn't think like, you know what I want to be when I grow up? I want to be a decoration in some jackass DJ's house in Portland, Oregon. I'm hoping that my head will be cut off, boiled clean, and I will just, I will be set down next to a guy's car keys in Portland. You know, and then every now and again, like one of his dogs will just sort of try to pull me off the shelf and he'll sort of laugh and shoo the dog away. And then he'll put me back on the shelf and I'll just sit there across from a piece of Sharon Tate's fireplace in Portland.
See, and me personally, I can think of fewer ways I would rather be memorialized. That would work for me. I'm good with that.
If I had asked that guy, George, when he was alive, if I'd said, like, I want you to list like 500 things you think might become of your body when you're dead, he never would have come up with a thousand monkeys, you know, typing on 1,000 typewriters would not have come. Does it make you wonder what might become of you someday?
Oh, I do. I do wonder.
Like if Patrick turns away for a moment, he looks back, Dawn's gone.
Yeah, if I think I'm getting past my prime for offering my body for science. But, you know, I've always thought I'd be perfectly happy with being one of those cadavers that they rip up into little pieces to do experiments on and to
I don't think that's the clinical term for how they proceed.
To teach people stuff and things like that. But, you know, I'd be happy to I don't know if it's possible or how you would do it, but I'd be perfectly happy to will you my skull.
I was actually just going to say you should will your bones to people. Ooh, hey, can you sell your bones before you're dead? Blah, 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 to make my bread. Can you – but, I mean, could you, like, go, like, look, don't, you know, like, don't go – you know, I know you might want to root for my death or maybe do more than root, but you can't have it until I die of natural causes, and if you kill me, you'll be cut out of the will. But I'll sell you, like, in advance, like my femur or, like, my skull or, you know, something. Hmm. And this is a guy gives you, like, $100, and then when you're dead, like, he gets the femur.
I don't know. I mean, because, you know, you're not legally allowed to sell your body parts.
Well, so, aren't but- you? Can't no. you sell? You can sell your body to science.
I don't know if you can sell it. I think you can, like, you can grant it. You can will it. You can't sell it. It's that whole thing about, like, you can't sell your livers or your kidneys or things like that because they're trying to keep a lid on the black
market. Well, you always hear about people selling their body for science. Is that a thing that
you
doesn't
don't
actually?
You sell it. You grant you.
I'm saying, but you hear that phrase though.
Well,
people like is that? But is that just a phrase? Is that a thing that doesn't actually exist?
That's just a phrase.
Well, that's a bunch of crap. You can sell your blood. Why can't you sell your bones?
Because your blood is regenerative, I guess.
Well, but you're going to be dead, though.
I know. They just – the people who – I personally think that if you want to sell one of your kidneys, you should be allowed to go on eBay and sell one of your kidneys.
All right. Seriously, how much
but
am
you're
I –
not allowed.
How much am I bid for Don's remaining femur, like right now? All right. Well, you know, it's hard to find the answers. There's no 800 number you can call for these things. Jesus God. All right. Let's do something else, shall we?
Okay.
All right. That's something else, by the way, is a mention of Squires Electric, one of our fine business partners here at the Rick Emerson Radio Program and at the Emerson News Network. Squires Electric, you can contact them at squireselectric.com, just like it sounds. Squires Electric, squireselectric.com. You can also call them at 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. So we've already gone past Thanksgiving. We've gone past Black Friday. So now everybody's starting. Have you started decorating for Christmas?
I haven't yet.
Now, when does that happen? Do you have a specific date or like do you? How do you decide when to do that?
I don't really have a specific date. I just hadn't really gotten to thinking about it quite yet because, well, with being sick all weekend.
That's true.
What will probably happen is I will probably start when I get back with the tree.
With the tree.
Next Saturday.
It's going to be coming up a week from this past Saturday. So on Saturday the 4th, we'll be going. So that's probably, you know, and we've started to move our decorations upstairs, but we haven't really you know, put any of them up. They're just sort of, they're there, they're ready. So we'll probably do the same thing. So as you decorate your home, whether you put up your tree, whether you're stringing it with lights, or you're putting lights outside or on the lawn. I was at Walgreens this weekend, and it's like they already got the creepy animatronic, you know, like reindeer or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
They're like wicker deer, but they kind of do like, and it's sort of they kind of look like that dog from Reanimator or whatever, where it's, you know, is that the half dog? Is that Reanimator or is that Return of the Living Dead? You know, there's like the half dog in the science lab.
Yeah, I think that. Wow, I don't remember which.
Well, it's like one of those things. Anyway, they look creepy, but you know, whatever.
Or like the thing turning into the dog in the John Carpenter's The Thing.
Exactly. Somebody needs to sell that as a Christmas decoration, or possibly not. But you know, you got the lawn covered with those, and especially if you're on maybe one of those streets. Maybe that's even an official. Maybe it's just sort of an unofficial arms race between you and everybody else in your block, trying to see who's the jolliest of them all. Meanwhile, you're just, you know, they're having to siphon in power from like five different states, just to power everything that's in your front yard. So you want to make sure that your house is up to speed, that, you know, it's got the wiring necessary to sustain this power. It's not going to cause any problems for you. Maybe if it's the first winter you've lived there, if it's a house that's, you know, 50, 60, 70 years of age. Or, you know, once, if you're already looking towards, you know, springtime, you're going to be remodeling. Maybe you're going to be expanding your business, moving somewhere else. You want to make sure that everything is working. Or if you got to get, you know, something replaced, it's got the smoke damage, water damage. It's got to be upgraded. It's got to be augmented, installed in some way. 503-252-1609 is how you contact Squires Electric. That's 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com. 503-252-1609, a proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson Radio Program. They are licensed, bonded, and insured in electrical inspectors, installers, and supervisors. Squires Electric. Find out more at squireselectric.com.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
This year has been a little crazy for the Andersons. You may recall we had some trouble last year. The robot council had us banished to an asteroid that hasn't undermined our holiday cheer. And we know it's only by the marks we make on the wall. That's our favorite time of year. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime, where we're working in a mine for our robot overlords. Did I say overlords? I meant protectors. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime. On every corner there's a giant metal Santa Claus who watches over us with glowing red eyes. They carry weapons and they know if you've been bad or good. Not everybody's good, but everyone tries. And the rocks outside the airlock exude ammonia-scented snow. It's like a winter wonderland. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime, where we're working in a mine for our robot overlords. Did I say overlords? I meant protectors. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime. That's all the family news that we're allowed to talk about. We really hope you'll come and visit us soon. I mean, we're literally begging you to visit us and make it quick before they...
Message redacted.
Now it's time for Christmas dinner. I think the robot sent us a pie. You know I love my soil and green. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime, where we're working in a mine for our robot overlords. Did I say overlords? I meant protectors. Merry Christmas from Chiron Beta Prime.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us today. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. In just a moment, we'll be joined by film critic Eric D. Snyder. He writes for CinematicalandFilm.com. He's also going to talk to us about his experience flying into and then out of Salt Lake City International Airport, a wretched port of souls through which I will be passing later on this year, about 2 weeks from now. I mean, not wretched because of his presence there. You know what I mean? Here's the thing, it's wretched on the way in. You know, on the way out, you know, it becomes a glorious portal, taking you to a better place, to a better life. I mean, really, you could just spin a globe and just have them take you to wherever you go. You know,
anywhere other than here.
The Republic of the Congo, fantastic. Don Taylor is tracking the following stories for you on this Monday.
Oh, I didn't know I had to track more stories. I'm not tracking any stories.
Dawn Taylor's tracking absolutely nothing. Nothing is being tracked by her in any way, shape, matter, manner, function, or form.
I refuse to track.
Okay, then. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Oh, I think David Walker's intro music was somehow left in the Eric Snyder slot.
Oh.
All right. Well, there you go. It's like a chocolate in my peanut butter kind of a thing. Eric Snyder, you can read him at Cinematical as well as at film.com. And you can find out all about him at Eric D. Snyder. That is Eric with a C and Snyder, S-N-I-D-E-R, EricDSnyder.com. Wow, I feel like we ought to be sort of running through the streets of San Francisco Quinn Martin style.
You have never been so funky.
I know. At first I thought it was porn music. And I was like, oh, good. My intern sent the right music over.
I believe this is actually chase music from one of the sequences of Blackula. I think this is called Blackula Strikes, but I could be wrong about that.
That does sound like David Walker's kind of music.
It really does. It was like you can just sort of reach into the Blackula bag at any, you know, and it always works. Hey, so before we do anything else, before we talk about the movies or any some such, so you went to Salt Lake. Did you fly actually on what is it, the 24th, I guess, the day before Thanksgiving?
I flew, yes, it was the day before Thanksgiving.
The so-called opt-out day.
Yes.
So you flew from Portland mm-hmm. to Salt Lake City, and then you flew back,
on Friday.
So what was the experience? So you flew there on Wednesday. What was the experience like, first of all? Because you didn't go anywhere. I didn't go anywhere. The people we know, like Greg and Sarah, they drove. So I know very few people who flew. What was PDX like? Was it just insane?
I was prepared for complete insanity. And on being driven there, I didn't bother to adjust my microphone before we started. So I think you're having trouble with it.
No,
I'm sorry.
You sound mellifluous and wonderful.
Good. So I was expecting all hell. And on the way there, there were people at one of the overpasses next to the airport protesting. They're protesters against the invasive screening procedures, which they do not have at PDX. They don't have the porno X-ray machine.
Maybe they're rehearsing
at PDX. Yeah,
sort of a dry run.
But I thought if anything is Portland, it's protesting things that have nothing to do with us.
Yes,
we just like to protest.
Yeah, that's it. It's like, well, it's Wednesday. What are we protesting? I don't know.
What have you got?
Yeah.
So I in the airport itself, though, this was like 12:30 in the afternoon, and the place was dead. Like, all the lanes for the security checkpoint were open, and there was no waiting. There were 6 lanes open. There were 5 people ahead of me in line. It was dead. The TSA agents were even remarking on how, I said, it's pretty quiet. And the guy was like, yeah, I'm surprised too.
Is that because everybody flies, what, like later in the day or something?
I think it was earlier in the morning. I think earlier in the morning. I guess because I was only flying one time zone away. If you're flying to the East Coast, you want to leave early Wednesday morning
that's
or
true.
Else it's going to be night before you get there. So I think early in the day it had been crowded.
So then when you – so you got to Salt Lake. And by the way, just not to be the guy who talks about the weather, but were you there when there was like, I don't know, Hellstorm 2010 or whatever was going on?
There was supposed to have been blizzard conditions the night before, and then they'd got like 1 inch of snow and not even really south of Salt Lake. And then the day that I flew – It was the day it was super cold. It was like a high of 17 and a low of 3 or something like that.
A low of 3.
Yeah. It's like, why bother even having degrees when you're just going to have 3 of them?
Seriously, can we all agree that if the temperature is one syllable, I mean, it's a place you don't want to be.
Yeah. Yes. And that was cold. Even by Utah standards, that's unreasonably cold. But the weather was clear. They had a lot of snow like Saturday
In my experience, the thing about Utahns is like they're always sort of primed for the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the deal. You know, it's like whenever, you know, and I mean literal and figurative apocalypses there, you know, so
right.
the actual rapture, you know, that's coming down the pipeline at some point in their assessment. So they're sort of ready for that.
Sure.
But because they're ready for the actual apocalypse, when it's like, you know, just like an apocalypse like of fog or something, you know, or of, you know, or of weevils, you know, it doesn't matter. They're like, they're ready.
People like, they like a test run.
Yeah.
Because actually, you probably know this, the Mormons who occupy most of Utah are big on emergency preparedness
yes.
and food storage. And so many people have in their basements rows and rows of food storage, which is a smart idea anyway, obviously. Like, you're supposed to have at least like a 3-day supply. Some people have as much as a year's supply of food and canned goods and wheat and flour, whatever. And so, yeah, when there's a little mini apocalypse, they're like, yeah, we get to sort of see how this will go when the real thing comes.
I got to tell you, my wife's uncle, so he worked for, he's in his 80s now, but he's like one of those guys you really want to be like. Do you ever see like an old guy, you know, and he'd just be like, that is exactly what I want to be like when I'm a senior citizen. You know, like they're still, you know, like they're still sharp. You know, they still got it together upstairs. You know, they're not trying to act younger than they are, but it's like they don't just let themselves go.
Still sexy.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing says sexy like, you know, like the light blue pants that are cinched really, really tight, a little bit higher than necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But he worked at Lockheed, so he's like, he's just a smart guy to begin with, and he's kept up with technology. The last time I saw him, he was like talking to me about like, how I really ought to go with an LCD TV over like the plasma because it has to do with like pixel burnout or whatever. And he's like, I'll draw you a schematic. Hold on. I'm like, all right, that's awesome. But he's like one of the smartest guys I've ever met in my life. Very, very straight-laced Mormon. So it's this great confluence of like, true believer, you know, very, you know, very upright and very, you know, very,
faithful.
Very, very, very much a loyal follower of the church. He's one of the faithful. But then also like a weird sort of like mad scientist kind of thing to it, where he doesn't just store the year's worth of canned goods. It's like in the basement behind like an airlock sort of a thing that
nice.
You open up. I mean, it really is like, it's like that place underneath Colorado where they keep like genealogical records and Johnny Carson episodes. It's mm-hmm. it's awesome. So I'm telling you, man, if it ever looks like, you know, like the apocalypse, like zombie or otherwise is upon us, I'm heading to that guy's
exactly.
house.
Exactly. I mean, we make our jokes, but when it comes down to it,
oh, yeah.
that's who you want to be on good terms with.
I'm telling
you. The bunker.
Right now, and I got to say, like, everybody talks about, like, you know, they make these movies where it's, you know, it's like zombies versus sharks and zombies versus vampires and vampires versus robots and ninjas versus pirates and whatever. I want to see like a full on, like Mormons versus Scientologists. Throw down. Because, you know, because the Scientologists, they, you know, they try really hard. They try to have this sort of like badass image. And they're, you know, like, you know, when is that thing that, what's his, the creepy guy that runs the church? He always says that thing about like, when the going gets tough, pit bulls call a Scientologist, you know, and then he kind of does a, you know, and, you know, whatever. And he says it with this weird sort of plasticky, like he's been buffed to a high shine kind of look. But I got to tell you, like, if you really want something done right, you know, you call Mormons because they know what they're doing.
The Scientologists have probably greater celebrity power as far as that battle would go. But celebrities tend to be wusses.
See, and
like they tend to be cowards and chickens.
And you know what it is?
The Mormons are hardy.
That see, and that's the thing. Mm-hmm. It's like Mormons. They are the speaking softly and carrying the big stick. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. That's horsepower is all underneath the hood. It's not on the outside. There's no flash there.
Although I will say though, as I mentioned last week, after we went to saw it, we went to the Mormon church Annie Get Your Gun performance. And
yes.
It was very polite.
Was it? You said it was very restrained.
It was the most polite musical theater I've ever seen.
Yes.
It was just, there's no business like show business. I don't want to overact because I don't want to show anyone up.
I've never looked at it that way before. I suspect it was probably more just embarrassment and not being very confident as actors. But I hadn't thought of it before. It's just humility.
Yes.
Well, just they don't want to act too much.
And you don't want to wake the 500 children that are in the audience.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, there's always – here's the thing. Let me just ask you this. Here's the – so, you know, you grew up Mormon, did you
mm-hmm.
not? Okay. So here – the thing about the Catholic Church is for all of their faults – and they are legion, by the way. But for the Catholic Church's many, many, many faults, I got to tell you, there's a couple innovations. One – is the crying room. And the crying room is like this – it is this soundproof sort of vestibule. It's like this adjunct room where you can just stash the kids and the parents who brought them there, and they get the church service. It's like – and there's a big – you know what it's like? It's like that – it's like the maternity wing at the hospital, you know, where you stand in the hallway and you go, that one's mine right there, you know. And it's like the soundproof window and all the babies inside. But it's not babies. It's like babies and their mothers and their fathers or whatever. And they get the church service piped in so they can see it, they can hear it, but we can't hear them.
Now, there was a crying room of sorts at this LDS church.
Yeah, really? some of the newer LDS churches do have – they call it the mother's lounge, like for nursing mothers and stuff. And the sound is piped in, but you wouldn't be able to see.
And when we went to see this play, people were – carrying their crying children and stuff out.
Yeah.
It's just they tended, first of all, to wait way too long before mm-hmm. they started
yeah,
doing it.
Maybe
they were mostly sitting way up at the front by the stage and had to carry them all the way
sure.
back to the back.
See,
where
that's
everyone.
That's always a problem. The baby starts crying. Is this just going to be like a 2-second outburst, or do you wait it out? It's like waiting for a hurricane.
Yeah.
Do you wait it out? Do you take your chances? Do you run now?
And they do that thing that parents sometimes do. He'll cry himself to sleep.
Right.
You know? And it's like, you know, maybe eventually, I guess.
The other thing is the more babies there are, the less people are conscientious about it. Like if you've got the only baby in the congregation, you're like really self-conscious about it. But if there's a million babies and they're all making noise, like I went to my brother who lives in Utah. I went to his ward. He lived out in Eagle Mountain for a while, which is this weird place or the Stepford Village where houses are cheap. So newly married couples go there for their first houses. And that was my brother and his wife. And so everyone in his ward, the Mormon congregation, was either 28 years old or 3. Like, there were no teenagers. There were no old people. It was all young couples and their kids. And that place was a zoo.
No,
because everyone had a baby.
Oh, man. And it's like, I'm just saying that it's like, you know, my in-laws, they're, you know, they're simple people in some ways, the mm-hmm. common clay of the New West. And so there's nothing they love more than going to the Chuck-O-Rama buffet.
Sure.
And it's like you go – and it's the same thing. It's just like you – in the rest of the country, like you go to those buffets and it's largely just old people.
Right.
But again, you go there in Utah and it's like it is the entire spectrum because it's like you got to feed the entire family for like $9.
Yeah, I mean it's cheap and you got a lot of kids.
Well, it's like here. You go to a hometown buffet and you have a lot of Hispanic families. And depending on where you go, when I used to go to the one – I can't remember. There was one we went to. If it was the one off over on like Sandy or whatever, that also seemed to get a lot of Russian families.
Oh, yeah.
Which was really bizarre.
I know exactly the place you're talking about, too.
And yeah, and so you would have, like, lots of your, you know, the thing is, like, you're eating cheap and the food's not terrible, but part of the trade-off is there are always, like, small children about 1.5 feet high just running past you up and down constantly the whole time you're eating.
My theory about this is, well, there's only two ways to go with that. One is to assume that the kids are like a ticking alarm clock that, you know, like a week after you buy it, you don't hear the tick anymore. It's just there constantly, and you are immune to it. It just washes right off you. Or, and this is the theory that I choose to embrace, that parents who have unruly children, that they remember with some sort of like a bitter fondness the time before that child existed. And so what they want to do is they want to inflict just a little bit of that special hell on the rest of us. You know? It's just sort of a, look, we're all going to suffer together kind of thing. You know, I will not be alone in my misery. And so they take the child to some place where there's going to be a lot of childless folk.
Sure.
And so that we can, you know, and so that we can have just the tiniest sip of their pain and torment. But, you know, but I could be off about that.
Thanks to Brenda Vaccaro for joining us, too, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I just noticed that.
real quickly,
Sam Elliott.
Before we get back to the news, I wanted to ask, somebody asked where the performance of Annie Get Your Gun was, because they said that I've closed the email, but he said he almost got taken to see it, and then he came up with some excuse, didn't go. But he wanted to know if this was the performance he was going to have to see.
It was out in Hillsboro, and it was just Friday and Saturday night, the weekend before Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah, and it was on this church that was like on
200 Southwest 206th.
Yeah,
way out in
Hillsboro. In between Farmington and TV Highway.
Yeah.
Let me just say, by the way, you've never lived until you've seen a Mormon production of West Side Story, which was just glorious. Glorious. And where it's like, I don't know if they had like that, like the sort of airbrushing tan thing in the alley out back where they were just, all right, sharks over here, sharks. But I mean, it was like relentlessly white. But then somehow they were all like this very, you know, like a finely basted turkey.
Nice.
When they came out on the stage. So.
I was really impressed because they had a lot of most of the costumes obviously were, you know, made particularly just for the production. Then you had like the townsfolk ladies that were just wearing long skirts of various colors with a black cummerbund and a white blouse, which I leaned to our friend Debbie and I said, did they pick this play because they already had the clothes? And then there was the guy who played Sitting Bull, and he had like this full Indian headdress.
Yeah.
So I got completely distracted by that because I kept thinking, did they already have a headdress? Did they know a guy with a headdress? Did they have to go to a costume place and rent a headdress?
They probably did.
What does it cost to rent a headdress? Could I get a headdress? What would I do with a headdress if I rented a headdress? And then I realize I've missed like half a musical number because I've just been thinking about the Indians.
Half a musical number, or in other words, 20 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, that first act was...
And, you know, that
long.
First act was 90 minutes, but on the actual Broadway production, it probably was 90 minutes.
Yeah.
It probably just wasn't boring.
Yeah.
Like, that's a normal length for the first act of a Broadway show, but yeah.
We're here with Mr. Eric D. Snider. You can find out more about him at ericdsnider.com. We'll talk movie stuff here in just a skosh, as our Asian friends say. In the meantime, this is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
A brownie baking burglar made himself at home this week in Jacksonville, Florida, until a concerned neighbor found a gun-toting intruder inside Thanksgiving morning and fled.
I'm sorry, where?
Jacksonville, Florida. But first, the burglar surfed the victim's computer for pornography, slept in his bed, stole his gun, drank his orange juice, and was apparently trying to steal his pickup and liquor before he was found, according to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office.
Liquor?
The homeowner had been out of town on vacation since Tuesday, so a neighbor decided to check out the vacant Northwest Jacksonville home at about 10 a.m. Thursday when he noticed one of the garage doors was open. Finding nothing out of place in the garage, he closed the door and called the homeowner's wife just in case. She asked him to check inside, so he used a spare key. That's when the neighbor was confronted by a young man in the living room who pointed a gun in his face and said, whoa, hold up, according to a police report. The neighbor ran back outside and called the police, who surrounded the home and searched it with a dog, but found no one. What they did find was evidence he had gotten into an unlocked car in the driveway and opened the garage door with the remote. The gun he had stolen was from the homeowner's bedroom. Police found remains of brownies he had baked and several pornographic websites active on the home's computer. The keys to the pickup were in the vehicle, along with a nylon bag of stolen liquor on the front seat.
You know, the thing about criminals, you know, I guess in general, but specifically in Florida, is they're like criminals in Florida are like a mayonnaise soda, you know, where it's like they've got it half right. Because on the one hand, you know, it's like sometimes they will have these schemes that are just like so unbelievably elaborate and complex, just these labyrinthine sort of, you know, plots that they hatch. And then it's like, you know, it's like this guy, where it's like he's been able to get into the home undetected, to stay there for some time. But then it sounds like the second half of the plot was just to touch as many things as possible, presumably with an ungloved hand, and then just, you know, sit around and, you know, and give himself a good, you know, spank while making brownies or something, just waiting for the neighbor to show up.
Just figuring, well, they're not going to be back until after Thanksgiving. What could go wrong?
It's inconceivable that I'll be found out. I mean, it really is just like the most amazing self-defeat mechanism that's wired into so many of the people in that fine state.
Maybe he just really wanted porn and brownies and had no other outlet for it.
Well, look, I want porn and brownies. You want porn and brownies.
Sure.
We all want porn and brownies. But, you know.
Not as much as that guy, apparently.
Apparently not.
No. I don't think I would break into someone's house for porn and brownies.
It'd have to be really. I mean, it would have to be. I mean, they would both have to be of just, like, you know, really the utmost delicacy and refinement.
It would
refinement.
Have to be like those Ghirardelli brownies.
Just like the moistest and the most chocolatey. And the brownies would have to be good, too.
And I want. That's way better than the Andrew Blake joke I was going to make. Well done. Here's Don Taylor.
Let's do our snuff watch.
Here is your snuff watch for Monday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Here is Don Taylor with your snuff watch.
Leslie Nielsen, who starred in The Naked Gun and Airplane, passed away on Sunday at a hospital near his home in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. He was 84 and was being treated for pneumonia. The master of parody boasted a talent for delivering ridiculous lines in the straightest way possible, cloaking outright absurdity and straight-faced obliviousness. Ironically, the foundation of his craft was built early in his career as a dramatic actor. After serving in the Royal Canadian Air Force and studying at New York City's famed Actors Studio, the Saskatchewan-born Nielsen popped up in the early 50s on television. He received his first big film break playing Commander J.J. Adams in the 1956 sci-fi flick Forbidden Planet. Over the next few decades, he established himself as a reliable, handsome, rich-voiced actor who graced myriad TV dramas like Peyton Place and Dr. Kildare and films such as The Poseidon Adventure. His career took a comical hard left turn when he was cast as Dr. Rumack in the 1980 big-screen parody film Airplane. 2 years later, he was tapped by the Airplane brain trust to play Lieutenant Frank Drebin in the cop show spoof sitcom Police Squad. Although the series lasted only 6 episodes, Nielsen earned an Emmy nomination for the work, and in 1988 re-inhabited the bumbling Drebin again for the big screen adaptation The Naked Gun.
Now, he was in Zero Hour, I believe, which was the film. To whatever degree Airplane is based on any particular film, everybody goes right to Airport. But I think it was there are whole sequences in Airplane, I think, that are taken from this film called Zero Hour.
Right about that.
Which it has to do with, and I've only ever seen it once, and it was a long time ago, but I think it has to do with like a, maybe a bomb threat on an airplane or something. Some sort of crisis. And I think Leslie Nielsen is in the movie, and I think he either plays a pilot or a sort of doctor-like role, a role not on, because I think that's why they cast him.
I recall hearing that bit of trivia before, so it must be true.
I think it was a thing that I might have only seen the film after hearing one of the Zucker guys talk about it. By the way, I got to tell you, if you've ever listened to the commentary for the movie Airplane, it is back to the mayonnaise soda thing where it's like half genius and half like. Have you ever listened to the commentary for that?
Uh-uh.
Here's the thing about it, and it has the Zucker Abrams Zucker you know triumvirate. They're all there, and it's brilliant. I mean, it's a fantastic commentary for like the first, I don't know, 35 minutes, and then they literally just run out of things to say, and there's long sections of, and at one point. You know, it's like Abrams at one point just literally says, I think unironically, like, so, anybody heard any good jokes lately? No one has heard any good jokes, by the way. And then it just lapses into silence again for like another 19 minutes.
Wow.
And then I think at the end of the commentary, they just apologize for taking your money. but they cast him, I think, because he was in Zero Hour. And then that was – and it's – I was thinking about this last night when I pulled that clip that we opened the show with where he's given the whole George Zip speech. And there's two things about Airplane. One – I don't remember a time when I hadn't seen that film. Like, I don't remember the first time I saw it. I don't know when it was. It was on TV, undoubtedly, but I don't know how old I would have been. I have no recollection. It's just like it was there, like a total recall memory. Like it was just stuck in my head, and I don't know. Like I was born with it or something. Secondly, not unlike not unlike Feedback and the White Album, I wish that I'd sort of lived before Airplane so that I could know a before and after period. Which leads me to point three, which is that it really is astonishing how those guys, to a large degree, just invented, you know, a genre. And it's not like it hadn't been done before that, because there was, like, Get Smart, and there was, you know, some of the, you know, the things that predate. But, I mean, Airplane is really just such an amazing game changer of a film. I mean, it really is just, it's a huge dividing line.
Well, and I'll say, as the oldest person sitting here, that I did live in a world pre and post Airplane.
What was it like?
Well, never mind. I was going to go in a different direction. But I do remember seeing Airplane when it came out. And that was one of those films that if you were talking to people who hadn't seen it yet, you just quoted them entire scenes, just telling them why it was so damn funny and why they needed to see it. And if you were talking to someone who had seen it, you stood around for like an hour just talking about what the funniest things were in it.
It became a common language.
Yeah, yeah. It was very quotable and really memorable and really unlike anything else that had been in movies ever before.
And you know what's – maybe you guys have talked about this. I'm not the first person to make the observation, but Leslie Nielsen – was in so many really bad movies.
Oh, yeah.
So many awful, awful spoof comedies where they cast him because of the Airplane and Naked Gun.
Yes, Dracula Dead
and Loving It.
Example.
Get out of my head. It's like a fifth time today.
And so many of them. So many of them went straight to DVD. There's probably probably another 10 still waiting to come out on DVD. And yet the stink of those movies never got on him.
Right.
Like, people still loved him anyway, and still, it would have taken a million of those to outweigh Naked Gun and Airplane.
Well, it's like, you know, that's the same thing. It's like Christopher Walken and Tommy Lee Jones both have that sort of that Teflon thing. I mean, Christopher Walken, I mean, he could star in a film that consisted of him coming to your house and punching you in the face and then, you know, and then burning down your home. And you'd be like, well, yeah, but it's, you know.
And he could freely admit later that it was a terrible movie and he only did it for the money.
Yeah.
And it doesn't change anything.
You know,
love Christopher Walken.
It just doesn't get on at all. It's same, you know, and it's kind of the same thing. I've thought about this with Mel Brooks, too. Whereas Mel Brooks, it's like he just, he just accomplished so much and created such a staggering amount of comedy in a short period of time. Even though that now chronologically constitutes a minority of his career, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
You know, it's like, I think did he make Dracula Dead and Loving It?
He did.
Yeah,
it was
okay. See, so there you go. So that yes.
Do you have a? Is that a spider?
A
on you?
God!
Or
I don't even
shirt.
Want to look.
It's
I don't
black.
Know.
It fell off your headphones.
Is there a spider on me?
Well, I think it might just be some.
Oh no, it's a piece of
plastic.
No, it's a piece of plastic in my headphones.
Okay. All right.
Okay,
damn
now,
you!
Now it's in your armpit.
Okay. Well,
I'm sorry. Well, the way it moved.
Yeah,
I
was nervous too at first.
No. My headphones are half-lifing away.
Okay.
All right. Avert your eyes.
You know who else? Steve Martin is another one.
Steve Martin.
Mostly bad movies anymore, but who doesn't love Steve Martin?
You know, but it's the same. There's bands who do that. There's bands that just put out Drek, you know, year after year after year, but it doesn't matter because it's like, you know, you put out like the Stones are that way. Their career is, you know, chronologically it's so top-heavy with hits that it doesn't matter, you know, that the tail of it is, you know, the last 30 years have been, you know, to put it politely, hit or miss.
Right.
So final thing about Leslie Nielsen. Well, first of all, he's one of my favorite horror films of all time. He's in Creepshow and he's just fantastic.
Oh, right.
Just hilarious and evil all at once. And he, and the thing is, here's the other thing about Leslie Nielsen is even post Airplane, he was every now and again able to pull off a role where he was able to, like, you could take him seriously, where you somehow amazingly forgot that he was the guy from Airplane, which is difficult to do. I mean, I think Joe Bluth, his name is Will Arnett, he's having a hell of a time with that, where you look at him and you just see Joe Bluth.
Right.
And I always like guys who are able to step away from that comedic persona, even though the persona is based so much on just their own mannerisms, which makes it harder to get away from. But he was, you know, he was able to do that to some degree.
I think that's why he was so good in the comic roles, is because he seemed, even in the comic roles, he seemed so deadpan and serious.
Right.
And so that his persona was that of the guy who is not the way his persona is.
Well, I think that was the whole thing with that film, like with Elmer Bernstein, who did the score. Where I think the first time Bernstein did the score, it was sort of kooky and zany, and it was, you know, like, wow, 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 wow. And they said, you got to score this, like, and I think Robert Stack, they said, like, didn't get it.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't get, that doesn't make any sense. It's not funny at all. And I think it was either Peter Graves or Leslie Nielsen, where Robert Stack said, you know, he was just like, I don't get it. Where are the jokes in this script? And they just said, Robert, we're the joke. And he just went, all right. And he clearly had no, couldn't fathom at all what they were talking about, but plunged on ahead. So, all right, where they go. Leslie Nielsen, there's your Snuff Watch for Monday, right here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Still to come, we got your Job Watch and Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas. We got to talk Walking Dead as well, and we'll have a little discussion about that. Have you seen 127 Hours?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I'm going to ask you about that here here in a moment. And also, like I'm the last person that I haven't seen Harry Potter, and it's one of those first world problems where I was like, you know, my entire weekend was focused around one must do task, which was see Harry Potter, and then it's like I just ended up sitting there on my big snack whale's ass, like doing nothing. So I didn't get it done. So, but we'll talk about 127 Hours here in just a moment. The Rick Emerson Radio Program, brought to you by, among other folks, the fine people at Sorrell's Vintages, and Daniel, who is the owner and operator of Sorrell's Vintages. They've been there since 1990 for 20 years. They're at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. They're right across from the Baghdad Theater, right next to Powell's Books. 3713 Southeast Hawthorne. Have you been to Sorrell's Vintages?
I have not.
It is a fine place. You got to go there. Next time, if you're in the neighborhood, you're by the Baghdad Theater. Even if you're not, it's right next to Powell's Books. It really is just a fantastic, phenomenal place. So the store is split into two halves. There's half of it, which is American mid-century modern, which is what we commonly, you know, the Mad Men era stuff or Atomic Age things. And these aren't reproductions. These aren't duplicates. What they do is they actually go out around the Northwest, and they'll go to other stores or to estate sales, and they'll actually find, like, the best of the best of furniture and decorative items from the 50s, 60s, sometimes into the early 70s. And they'll just find the very best, and they'll bring it back. And when I say the very best, and it's actually the store looks so much pricier than it is. And you realize it's because, you know, first of all, you know, I think the smaller the town, the more inflated the prices on that sort of thing tend to be, you know, because there's not a lot of competition.
Right.
And also you go into like a thrift store, you know, they end up a lot of times just being sort of junk shops where everything is sort of crammed together and it's dirty and it's dusty and it's covered in grease and filth and you take it home and you got to spend all day like restoring it and getting it ready. You go into Sorrell's Vintages and I'm telling you, the stuff you find the perfect thing, you take it home, it's ready to go in your house right then. Now, that's one side. The whole other side is actually brand new items, and as you're heading toward the holiday season, a lot of those things under $25, a lot of things under $5 as well. And, you know, it's as much as I loathe the word, just with a white-hot intensity, I loathe the word quirky. I really do. But sometimes there's just no other word for it. But you really got to go check out the stuff in this place. It is fantastic. And you and I have talked about this before, that I think you've either gone in there, but it was a long time ago, or you've actually sort of looked through the window and have not gone in.
Yeah, it's always been, I've been at the Baghdad, and then it's like late at night, and they're not open. And so I've just stood and looked in the window longingly and just gone, ooh, look, I'd own that.
Like
oh.
A dog against the glass of a shelter.
Yeah, it's pretty much.
So you really, I'm telling you, before you get to, you know, don't let it get to be like the day before Christmas, you know, the week of Christmas, because then everybody and their brother's going to be there. You can go check them out at 3713 Southeast Hawthorne, right across from the Baghdad Theater and right next to Powell's Books. And please tell me you heard it here on the Rick Emerson Radio Program, won't you please? And it's Sorrell's Vintages. They've been there since 1990. Sorrell's Vintages, a proud sponsor of this, the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Excellent. All right, we are here with Mr. Eric D. Snyder. You can find him at ericdsnyder.com and film criticism as well at film.com and at cinematical.
Sorrell's Vintages, do they guarantee that their vintage items are not haunted?
I really don't know. We should inquire about that, because I got to tell you, there's a...
That's always a concern I have when I buy a vintage item.
It's an ashtray there that I'm keeping my eye on.
Well,
just... Because like that Friday the 13th TV show,
mm-hmm.
where every single thing they had in the store
yes.
had some kind of a curse on
yes.
it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was that the TV series where it was like a Needful Things kind of a place?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it was like every time they'd sell you something, like, what's this? Well, it's a blender, you know?
We only sell monkey's paws.
Pretty
basically.
Much, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think they'd stay in business long, because word of mouth alone.
You would think. That was before the internet.
Have you seen Merlin's Magical Shop of Mystical Wonders?
No.
Oh, man. I think you can only find it as the Mystery Science Theater version. I think it's Merlin's Shop of Magical Mystical Wonders or something.
Ernest Borgnine is the uncle telling the story.
It's so great. It's one of the worst things ever made. It was clearly where they had... I think what happened with that movie is that... There was a whole bunch of guys that just sort of like had each made about 20 minutes of a feature film and then ran out of money. Mm-hmm. And somebody else, like a Golan Globus type, sort of came in and said, "Hey, how much you want for these 20 minutes of three different films? I got the I got $5 and some green stamps. Here you go." And then they created a sort of anthology framework starring Ernest Borgnine for like reasons that that don't make any sense at all. And they just stitched these three fragments of films together into a kind of like pseudo Tales from the Crypt, the movie kind of a thing,
but very family friendly.
Exactly, except for the part about like one of those monkey's toys where he's got the symbols.
Oh, yeah.
And then, oh, yeah, he kills everyone in the house.
That's right.
So, and at the end, Merlin, who runs the shop that sold the monkey, and by the way, he never warned anybody about that. He didn't say, "Enjoy your monkey. It'll kill your family. Come again." You know, he just let them take it. And then it killed everybody in the family. And at the end, Merlin shows up, finds the monkey, and I swear to God, just waves like a sort of, like waggles a finger at them, you know, sort of like a tisk tisk monkey
naughty,
you
naughty.
Shouldn't, and then he takes it back to the store.
So like it was their fault for wanting a monkey?
It was, you know. It
sounds like Merlin's evil and he's trying to kill
people. Did he give
them
their money back?
They were dead.
Here's the thing, is the logical underpinnings of these movies never really hold together. If you lean on them, even they just collapse like a cardboard suitcase.
To keep selling the monkey over and over again and it just kills people and he gets the monkey back?
I think so.
And so he just keeps making money on the monkey over and over again?
I guess he's a slightly more malevolent version of that guy in Gremlins, you know, who who sells, I mean...
Again,
clearly,
why would
he didn't
sell
want to sell
things?
The Mogwai, though. His grandson sold it without his permission.
That's right. You know, because like 10 seconds of talking to Hoyt Axton, you say to yourself, like, this is not a man who can care for any living thing. Not even himself. Look at him.
No.
You know, and yet they just decide to just unload it. Have you ever read the Alan Dean Foster novelization of Gremlins?
I have indeed.
It's quite something, I got to tell you. Because here's what they do. They actually, they share Gizmo's thoughts with you.
And, like, tell us where he came from. He came from another planet.
Oh.
I don't remember him coming from another planet.
Yeah. There were I don't know if they ever said other planet, but they're definitely describing this other world that he had come from. And I read it when that movie came out. I was, like, 10 or 11, and I read the book.
Damn, we're nerds. All I remember is that at one point Gizmo describes how – here there's the there's the ancient sort of Chinese guy that has him, and that – and that the guy takes really good care of Gizmo and he feeds him properly and obviously protects him from for the elements and gives him a place to live and shelters him. But in exchange for that, Gizmo has to perform occasional tricks for the old man because the old man finds them delightful, including like just eating pieces of like rubber. So like the guy occasionally have like the Chinese guy will occasionally have like a rubber washer. You know, like from a piece of tubing, and he'll just give Gizmo a piece of rubber and Gizmo goes, you know, or whatever, and just to eat like a piece of plastic, you know, or whatever. Like, here, have a swizzle stick, Gizmo, and Gizmo just has to eat like the swizzle stick because it amuses the Chinese guy to no end. And it's like, well, it's the least I can do. You know, yep.
Oh, that reminds me of a lot of relationships sort of like, I've been in, actually.
Eat the swizzle stick.
In a metaphorical sort of a way.
Sort of like an it's a living kind of a thing.
Yeah, you know? Could be worse.
Jesus. All right. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Eric D. Snyder, film critic. 127 hours. So I don't know.
You never asked him about coming back through Salt Lake.
I guess that's a good point, actually. So did they backscatter? Did they give you the body scan on the way back through the airport?
That is an anticlimactic story because in Salt Lake they do have the porno X-ray machine, but at least they do in one of the terminals. And it was there when I was flying out. But again, the place was dead. They had that and they had like three other regular old-fashioned security things. And you could choose which line you went in. And I went in one of the regular ones, and that was it.
So, but it was up and running.
It was up and running, and people were in it. And I guess if you weren't paying attention, which line you got in, you would get in that one.
Were they causing a ruckus of any kind?
No, there was no ruckus of any kind.
See, so I wonder now if it's like if I because here's the thing is I just loathe going to Salt Lake just with everything in me, just like with the intensity of a supernova. I hate it.
But it's not because of the airport per se.
No, it's not because of the airport. No, I dislike going to Utah.
Because
it's
of where the airport is located.
It's because of Utah. But the thing is, screwing with them on the way out doesn't do me any good.
Right.
That's like a Pyrrhic victory at best because I'm just going to get I guess you'll get to stay in Utah longer.
Right.
So I don't know if I'm going to cause any sort of a any sort of a any sort of discord or whatever. But it's like I wonder if. if you do it on a day that, like, you know, if everybody else is just sort of getting, well, I guess they're scanning my anus, fine, and they just have quit resisting, like, if I then cause any sort of a stir, are they going to just, like, ignore me and just go, like, fine, okay, Mr. Starting the Revolution all by himself? Or are they going to be like, no, that's not starting again, and they'll take me in the back and just, like, beat me till I'm dust?
Could be that.
I just don't know how to deal with it.
If I had been forced or any way corralled into the back scanner machine, I would have opted out. I had decided I was not going to do that because Don knows this. My policy has always been: you can touch my junk if you want to. You just may not take a picture of it.
Is that it? So it's like you. It's not even an either or thing.
No, it's please do touch it. Please do.
As long as there's
no photography.
It's just sort of a, it's just no record of this event kind of a thing.
I may run for public office someday.
You operate with discretion.
Exactly.
So speaking of Utah, 127 hours.
Yes.
So I think it was actually you that mentioned this, that it's, I don't know, the sort of people bandying about, like, what are the best films of the year? And and I'm reading the book right now, and the book is far better than I expected because you think, you know, it's the sort of, it's like a high incident kind of a thing, you know, it's the one line description. And how could the guy possibly get like a 400 page book out of it?
Right.
And the book is fantastic. It is, you'll pardon the pun, gripping. So the movie, though, I hear is actually even better than the book.
I haven't read the book, but the movie is much the same way. You think, well, it's a guy stuck in a rock. How can that be a movie? And amazingly it is. Even without gimmicks, like, you could see how you can use gimmickry to use lots of crazy editing or crazy music or something to keep the energy up. And it's not even that. It's he shows us so many different facets of his mind and his memories and his regret, because it's kind of his own fault that he's in this situation. And the time speeds past.
Were there are there sections? I mean, it's obviously everybody knows the deal that he got pinned. True story, pinned underneath a boulder. He was in Moab, I think, and he has to lop off his arm to get out. It sounds like a dumb question, but how difficult is it to watch the screen the entire time? I mean, are there the big look away moments?
There are, and I think that Danny Boyle, the director, does a good job of playing on the fact that we do know how it ends. I think most people know that that's
right.
How it winds up. And so there are many times where you keep thinking, oh, this is it. Oh, here we go. And you're waiting for it, and then it doesn't happen. But there's a lot of tension of you kind of want to look away, and is this it? And then when the moment of truth finally does arrive, it's astonishing.
Really?
It's the sort of thing that has happened. I think just the day before I saw it, I had just rewatched the first Saw movie. Which contains some similar plot elements. And I realized I've seen a lot of hacking off of limbs in my life. Like, people hacking off their own limbs, hacking off other people's limbs. I've seen a lot of that. And what 127 Hours does is it makes that seem, like, real and important again. Like, it adds its dramatic intensity that's been taken away.
There's weight to it.
Yeah, it actually
– the...
And it feels – even though I've certainly seen it done more graphically and more grossly – this is the one that seems the most powerful and gross and graphic because it is this character that we know.
Why are you rewatching Saw? Was that like swinging two bats in the warm-up circle or something? Just sort of a...
It was because Saw 7, a.k.a. Saw 3D, was about to come out, and my co-host on Movie BS with Bear and Snyder, Jeff Bear, had not seen any of the Saw movies. So we watched the first one. And then I told him what happened on parts 2 through 6, and then we watched 7.
All right, so you and I were – so I was not alone then. You and I were the two that watched Saw 7.
Do you have the book with you, by the way?
The book upon which 127 Hours is based.
Yeah.
Show between it the picture.
Between a Rock and a Hard Place, the cover is the author, Aaron Ralston, and where his right arm, I swear to God, is just like a rappelling hammer.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, he really has become – and I always forget the reference, but he's become like that guy in He-Man that could just, you know, just like
– Man-at-Arms?
Is that what it is?
I
and it's
so,
like he can
it?
Just swap out a whole lot
yeah.
of like. All I can remember is like Duncan. What's his? Does Duncan? He doesn't become Man at Arms. Does it? I can never remember. They all have secret identities.
Only in the cartoon.
And I keep wanting to say
they didn't all.
No. Well, in any event, but
anyway.
He's got the whole, you know, like Swiss Army
hand
going on here,
which is smart. If you're going to do a lot of rock climbing and you lose your arm, replace it with a rock climbing thing.
Yeah, and it is that great thing of like, you know, going into the book what happens, and so then the entire thing is just like this long, slow death march, you know, getting to like the horrible thing that you know is on the horizon.
Mm-hmm. Some good sound effects in that scene.
We'll talk Walking Dead here in just one moment. This at the news desk is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
The Obama administration is furious over the release of diplomatic cables by the website WikiLeaks. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder says his department has launched a criminal investigation.
What is this? Hold on a second. There's like 500 different WikiLeaks. Release one?
Yes. To the extent that we can find anybody who was involved in the breaking of American law and who has put at risk the assets and the people that I have described, they will be held responsible. They will be held accountable.
I think it was somebody else earlier that said, by held responsible, we mean killed.
Holder also criticized the media for reporting on some of this information.
Who's to say?
I'm sorry. This is I've done that thing again.
Members of the press, people who come into possession of this information, I think, hope would act in a responsible manner. I think that has clearly not happened here.
So what is the deal with WikiLeaks? So this is just, it's just like WikiLeaks.com, right? It's like it's just a website. Like, it's not something like distributed, like it's not like a torrent or something. Like, it is just one website.
It's a website, but it's mainly a guy with his cohorts.
So how is it? I mean, I guess my question is, so like they're able to take down, like file sharing and torrent websites, even when they're based in countries where it's totally legal. Like, I think actually didn't just like over the weekend or something, didn't like the ICE or whatever it is, like the International Customs something or other, they just closed down like 75 different like BitTorrent sites or something. Again, even in countries where they were not breaking the law, because it's like the long arm of the man and so forth. So it's like, how is this guy still running a website?
Well, they're trying to stop him in a number of ways. First of all, what he did was, I mean, yes, it's WikiLeaks.com, but also before it ever even is officially released to his website, I mean, weeks ago, he released all of this information to the New York Times, to Der Spiegel, to Bild, to The Guardian. And so it's already been disseminated to the mainstream press.
So it's like the Jack Anderson thing, right? Just like making sure that everybody's got it.
Yeah. And for lack of any other, because as far as I know, the thing is, the WikiLeaks guy did not steal this information himself.
Right.
What he did was he acquired it and passed it on to someone else. So, for I think they have been trying to figure out ways they can charge him with things. The best they've been able to do so far is that a Swedish court is trying to, like, extradite him back to Sweden to charge him with, like, molesting children. I mean, honestly, they came up with some trumped up, like, you know, sexual depravity charges against him. For having sex with a couple of women, I guess, that ostensibly were underage. But it seems rather fishy, given what he's actually been doing, that's what they came up with.
See, stories like this are what always, like, give the lie to the whole, like, you know, 9/11 was an inside job kind of a thing. I mean, this is just, like, one guy. I mean, and it's not like we're averse to killing people. Yeah. I mean, our country, that's really all we do. I mean, you know, we make Saw films and then, we bomb things.
We're pretty good at it.
I mean, we've been doing it for a long time. We've really raised it to an art form. I mean, we have, it's our wheelhouse now. So you figure, like, you know, if they wanted to kill this guy, he'd just be dead. So that, I guess, in some small way gives me the tiniest, but either the government is just not, either they don't kill people like, you know, like they used to, you know, like it takes maybe a lot more to really raise their ire to that level, or just they've just gotten really bad at it, you know?
I have to think that we're still good at killing people if we want to.
You would think.
I think it must just be the slightly more heartening answer that it's just, well, we're gonna try not killing him.
Yeah.
I think what they do now is that if someone is especially high profile, they try not to kill him right away. You know, once the information has already gotten out there, basically they would have wanted to have killed him before this all got any further than it did. Now, if they kill him now, it just looks suspicious. Basically, what happens now is we wait, and about 8 months from now, the guy
dies.
He dies in a car crash.
You know what they ought to do? Here's the thing: as giving the government a tip here. Hey, attention to the government. Here's what you should do. A guy like this, I'm just saying, theoretically speaking, you know, because I always like to find the shortest distance between point A and point. I like to help people. If you're going to do something, you do it right. You don't kill the guy. You don't trump up charges. You don't do whatever. You just do something just much more unnerving, not quite as illegal. Like maybe, you know, while he's asleep, you just remove one of his legs. You know? Like, what if you went to bed and you'd had all your limbs and you woke up in the morning at, like, you know, one sock too many? I think you'd think long and hard, like, about who you emailed anything to from that point on. You know what I mean? You're not dead. And you just wake up and go, I could swear to Christ, like, I had two legs and I went to, all right, I'm just going to stay at home.
It's like 3 days later and you're just sort of bandaged up.
Yeah.
It's like that movie with Miguel Ferrer where he gets knocked over the head and he wakes up and he's missing a kidney.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
It's like, you know, the Manson family used to just sneak into people's homes and, like, just move their furniture around and then leave. You know, in a way, you know, there's a little more punch to that. You are listening to The Rick Emerson Show, brought to you by Castalia Language Center. You can find out more about them at portlandspanish.com. That is the website, portlandspanish.com. Castellalanguagecenter.com. Clara Grebel, the owner and operator of a Castellia Language Center. They offer Spanish language classes for adults, and in class sizes no more than 8 people. So it's you and how many of your compatriots, Don Taylor?
Siete.
That is exactly right. So you get near individualized attention if you took Spanish language classes when you were in high school or you were in college, and you got it there, and it just slid like right off your brain, like an egg off a Teflon skillet. You just, you find that you don't really learn things all that well when, A, you're just there because you're desperately trying to get out of high school and like your hometown so you don't end up in the box making factory, and B, because they're just having you memorize a bunch of stuff and then you have to like regurgitate it, and then it's like they kind of kick you out in the hall and you walk off to woodshop class to make a bong out of something.
Es no bueno.
Donde está la biblioteca? That's all I remember.
All right. See, I was just going to say, now somebody has gone to the MTC, or perhaps not. in any event, you can go to portlandspanish.com if you want to find out more about that. Castellia Language Center, they offer Spanish language classes for adults, and they can work with whatever your schedule is, whatever days of the week and hours of the day are best for you, and whatever your current level of Spanish acumen might be. They've got a class for you. That is portlandspanish.com. Please tell me you heard it here at the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Here is Dawn Taylor.
We have a Joy of Christmas watch.
Excellent. It's time for another exciting installment of Rick Emerson's Joy of Christmas on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. Have a happy New Year.
The best part is how he actually says, "Hey, look, everybody," right before the final gunshot, and then there's just silence ringing out endlessly.
That's my favorite.
Here's Don Taylor.
The religious message of Christmas is often forgotten amid all the partying and gift-giving at this time of year, so church leaders will be horrified to see their efforts further undermined by an atheist billboard which has gone up in New York. You can see this billboard, by the way, the graphic of it at rickemerson.com/pictures. A traditional nativity scene features a silhouette of a traditional of the manger, donkey, and the three wise men, which has been unveiled on a bridge tunnel. But thanks to a group called American Atheists, it comes with the message, "You know it's a myth. This season, celebrate reason." The sponsors hope the provocative anti-Christian message will convince closet non-believers who are praying to air to join their cause. It's located on Route 495 outside the Lincoln Tunnel in North Bergen on the New Jersey side.
This is why nobody likes atheists, by the way. Just FYI. Not even other atheists. Not even agnostics. Yeah. This is why you
and
don't
especially
get...
not God.
Who, by the way, I gotta tell you, that really is a thing where, you know, you would better be on the right side of the equation. Mm-hmm. Me, I like to think that I can sort of, you know, I can kind of limbo my way through whatever at the last moment, you know. And that's the great thing about being Catholic, too, is if it turns out that that's correct, like at the last possible, as the train is leaving the station, yeah, I can, I can resolve everything. But
if you're going to take the hardline stance.
Yeah.
Then you're right.
Run the potential of being really hosed.
Mm-hmm.
David Silverman, the president of the organization, said he was hoping to attract atheists who are currently in the closet with the billboard, which went up last Tuesday and is expected to remain up through the Christmas period. "I don't think it's any good for the kids," he said about Christmas.
Is he advocating not celebrating Christmas at all?
Apparently so, yes.
Well, yeah,
just
because,
do away with Christmas.
Of course, because what's the fun of being an atheist if you can't be like a joyless a-hole, well, you know?
He said, "We get blamed for a war on Christmas every year. This time we're actually going to pay attention to that. We're actually going to earn a little bit of that." We have been blamed repeatedly for being unpatriotic. We've been told that there are not atheists in foxholes. We have been told that we are immoral. Nobody has ever cared if we would be offended. While acknowledging everyone has the right to believe as they see fit, Mr. Silverman said his group believed there were a lot more people who were atheists but feared publicly admitting it. "A lot of people in church, a lot of people in the mosque, a lot of people in the synagogue know they're praying to air," he said. Despite the fact the billboard's only been up a few days, he and his group are calling the campaign a success. "We're getting a lot of response from closeted atheists saying, 'Thank you for putting that up,'"
he
said.
"For the love of God." It's like somebody just, I don't know, it's like the Atlas Shrugged section of Usenet just sort of vomited these people into the world. You know what I mean? Where they could just sort of walk around like some sort of non-believing golem, just tormenting the rest of us. For the love of Christ, let it go, friend.
Yeah, why is it that if there are people who, like, say, are extremists in some area, like we know that there are definitely extremists in the Christian faith, you believe that being an extremist on the exact opposite is somehow is somehow the best, the best solution to that.
You know, and the thing is, like, you know, and I'm not an atheist. I'm just sort of like, because what the hell do I don't even understand math. So, you know, or magnets. So, I mean, I got like no, you know, I got no sense of the existence or non-existence of God. But the thing about being an atheist is presumably if they think religion's such a big drag and whatever, part of the upside, it would seem to me, it's like, have you quit going to church? Suddenly you realize there's a whole other day in the week. My wife found this out. She's like, oh, my God, there's a whole other day. I get to do whatever. Because, you know, growing up in certain faiths, it's like you got the 6-day week or the 5-day week because 2 days set aside for the Lord and whatever. But it seems like being an atheist, part of the upside is, like, you don't have to worry about it anymore. You just be like, yeah, hell with that. And you just go on with your life and you shrug it off like a wet woolen
seems
jacket.
Seems like you should be more fun.
Right.
Not less fun.
Because you're not, you're not just, you know, walking around like Jacob Marley. You know?
But I know people like that. I know atheists who actually, it angers them that there are people who are religious. And again, I just sort of feel like, I feel the same way about them that I feel about people who are religious who get angry and take it personally that other people aren't religious. It's like, I feel exactly the same way. It's like, why do you care?
Just believe
what you believe and leave me out of it.
Someone like that who hates religion and is always going on about it, they're probably thinking as much about religion as religious people are.
Well, that's
defeats the purpose.
See, and that's the whole thing. It's like you'll never meet anybody who thinks about God more than an atheist. It's like the minute their feet hit the floor in the morning. And we all probably know many people who are atheists or whatever, who are maybe perhaps stridently, atheists. And I just kind of want to go like, man, you just relax.
If you're stridently anything, you're bad news.
Just unclench a little bit.
Yeah.
All right. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. There's your joy of Christmas for Monday, November 29th, 2010.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas.
Excellent. All right. So without further ado, we should probably talk Walking Dead from last night. Eric D. Snyder, do you watch Walking Dead?
I do indeed.
Excellent. Did you see last night's episode?
Uh-huh.
All right. For once, we are all on the same page.
Look at that.
Every now and again, like, Don and I will do this sort of like unofficial like tag team thing where we'll come in and at least one of us will have seen the show and one of us will have heard. Today, we have all seen it.
Or we'll have a guest and we'll go, we're about to talk about Mad Men. Of course, you watch Mad Men. And the person will go, no.
And by guest, we mean Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week.
Yeah.
Aaron Mesh doesn't watch Mad Men?
No, he didn't.
No, he doesn't. Well, his whole thing is he's just so – which I guess – I can get this because actually I think Kim Morgan said this one time years ago. She said that she was so busy watching movies, she just had no time to watch television. But to me, it's like the distinction between the two has just dissolved over the last 10 years.
You have to make time.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. As an American, it is your cultural duty. It's it's part of the imperative.
Mm-hmm.
Last night, episode 5, season 1, Walking Dead, the penultimate episode. So we got the finale, I guess, coming up next week. All right, so we'll start with our guest, Eric D. Snyder, last night's Walking Dead.
Well, it was a show that I watched, and there were some zombies, although they keep not calling them zombies. I'd like that we finally got...
Do they not say zombies?
They've never said zombies.
They call them the geeks.
Walkers.
They call them geeks and walkers. The word zombie has not appeared.
Is that a dumb question? Do you suppose that... Because, you know, nerds take this stuff really seriously, and so do I. I just... but is that because they run, and so therefore there's the guys who wrote the book don't want to call them zombies?
I think it's because it exists in a universe where there was no zombie culture.
I wondered about that, if they were ever going to reference that.
Because either it's that... Either you go that way or you have to go the other way, which is, wow, this is like Night of the Living Dead. Like, you have to acknowledge that they're zombies. And if they're not, then it must be that there's no concept for zombies in their culture.
I kind of wondered if they were, and so you've read the graphic novel.
Yeah.
If they ever at some point did the last action hero thing of going, wait a minute, these are zombies.
I don't think so. I really don't recall that.
Which is fine. I don't want to go with that. I like that we got a couple of answers last night about how long it's been going on. The guy on the CDC finally said it's been like 160 days since wildfire and like 60 some odd days since it went global. And so that answers the question of how long and is it just a local thing.
Right.
So it seems like they're parceling out some information. I was expecting to see him pushing a button every 108 minutes. It seemed like they were going what they were setting up.
It had that and then a little bit of I Am Legend thing. The lone scientist working on a cure, whatever. And there's only so many ways to stir the same drink. So, I mean, you got to expect that that's one of those tropes. And again, I'm coming at this not having read the graphic novel. I do think that last night's episode, by and large, was the best so far. I mean, of the 5. That would be my take on it.
I think that's how I felt as well.
It was really quite grim, but quite but it was it, but it never felt forced or contrived.
We spent a lot of time discussing body control,
right?
Like what we're going to do with our corpses, and I as much as I kind of found it like annoying, I really liked the guy. I liked a lot of the little moments where people had emotional responses to things that aren't necessarily logical, but they're very emotional. The guy saying that, you know, no, our people go over
right,
here.
Right.
They go over
we
here.
We bury the people, right. We burn, you know,
yeah,
the geeks or whatever.
My thought is like, really? Just their body. But, you know, I guess, you know, people do have very emotional responses.
And that's a thing that most zombie fiction doesn't address very much. Like that's that's what I like about the series, that we're seeing more of the human side of the zombies.
You know, and the woman holding her sister until
she turns.
And that was very tense, the way they drew that out, and you weren't sure how fast she was gonna be a zombie and what she was gonna do and what was gonna happen.
And I couldn't quite tell, and maybe it was deliberately I couldn't quite tell how much recognition was there, you know, of sister to sister, and how much of it was just like a zombie going, ooh, you know, hey, lunch or whatever. And, you know, and that was deliberately, I think, probably pretty vague.
Yeah.
But I'm a huge fan of shows. I like to see the mechanics of things that for which I have never really seen mechanics before. Again, like the, exactly what is the process of reanimation? Like, how long does it take? And how do you deal with bodies? And, just the actual day-to-day logistical underpinnings of how these things operate. Because so many times it's like they just uncork the zombies and then it's, you know, and everything just sort of unspools from there. But they don't actually show you how daily life works, which I guess is very much the point of... That's the point of the series, I guess, and the book overall, right?
Yeah, it really is very much, in a way, it's almost kind of like a soap opera. It's very much about the relationships between the people. But yeah, a lot of it is also just about the actual mechanics of their survival, where they go, what they do when they are in the different places they are. So, but there has to always be in every episode of this at least one thing that is just apparently really disturbing and gross and squishy to watch. And this one, the one for me, which I actually delighted in at the same time I was really disturbed by it, was the abused wife.
Oh, God, the pickaxe to the head.
Yeah.
The pickaxe to the guy's head.
That was fantastic.
And doesn't
it's just like, no, I'll take care of it.
He was my husband.
Just over and over again.
She looks like Jamie Lee Curtis.
A little bit, yeah.
You know who that is? Now, that's the woman. Have you seen The Mist?
Yeah.
She is the woman who walks out of the store with her son at the very beginning and says, won't somebody show a lady home? And they say, no. And then at the end, Tom Jane sees her go by on the truck. That's her. And she came to audition as an extra on The Mist, and Darabont really liked her reel and gave her audition and gave her a little role in The Mist. And so I'm glad to see that he's kind of brought her over this.
Yeah, that was a great moment, the axe to the husband's head.
It's a very, it was a very... visceral, very cathartic, but in a horrible, sort of awkward, rotted, ugly kind of a way. It was an ugly kind of catharsis.
Well, and I like, if you're going to make a movie about zombies and dead people, then don't mince words. Like, there it is. There's the gore.
Right.
That's what it looks like.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing is, it doesn't seem gratuitous either, because it's like it would be conspicuous if it wasn't shown. Somebody says, did you notice any difference in how this episode was filmed? Says, I watch the HD version every week, and this one looked less like film and more like video, but not quite video. Said, I thought, he talks about that maybe it was his reception or whatever. He said, they must have used some weird digital camera or something. This almost looked cheaply filmed compared to the other four episodes. Maybe this is just something with the HD version. Did you guys think the show actually looked different last night?
I didn't notice anything that looked different, but then I didn't watch it. Eric may have watched it on a great big TV.
I did. However, DirecTV doesn't carry AMC in high definition. So even those of us with great big TVs and satellite still watch it in non-high definition. I didn't notice any difference from previous weeks, though.
It's almost, and I don't know if you've read the graphic novel, Eric, but it's almost cheating to ask Dawn, but I'm wondering, so we've got the final episode of the season coming up next week, and then a hiatus until, I guess, the middle of next year or something. Do we think it's the big cliffhanger? Do we think that they, you know, it seems like we've evolved past cliffhangers to some degree.
There was an interview with the guys in Entertainment Weekly, which is my Bible. And the Bible is my Reader's Digest. But they were talking about that and said there's not a cliffhanger, because when they made the six episodes, they weren't sure it was going to come back. And so there's, you know, they're setting stuff up, but there's not like a big cliffhanger.
All right. So
I did like at the very end of this episode, though, when the CDC guy finally opens up the gate and there's this bright, bright light.
Right.
And again, and there's actually that moment, which is really kind of nice, of where it's kind of like a lot like the hatch, mm-hmm. the light from the hatch in Lost, where except that we know that there's a guy in there.
Right.
But they standing on the outside, it's like, this is open the door, open the door, open the door. And then the door opens and there's this moment that we're left in where they're standing there and you can tell they're just like going, okay, but do we really actually want to go in there?
Right,
right,
right.
And that's where they ended. It was kind of awesome.
Very nice.
So Walking Dead, we will have the discussion of the finale next Monday. That is a week from today, the finale for season one. It's just no way to do a graceful segue out of this. I just... Zombies to Christmas trees. I really desperately didn't want to do this, and yet here we are. I will take a moment to say that if you are enjoying this very fine radio program, perhaps the observations and musings of Eric D. Snyder, our Walking Dead recap, or any of the other fine pieces of entertainment you've heard today, you can thank one of our business partners for that. That is Christmas Mountain Trees. And Christmas Mountain Trees, you can find out more about them by going to their website. That is ChristmasMountainTrees.com. This coming Saturday, which is Saturday, December 4th, Dawn Taylor and myself are going to be at Christmas Mountain Trees at the actual location of the family farm. Mm-hmm. And we will be selecting Christmas trees, one for your home.
Indeed.
One for my home, one for the break room here at the Emerson News Network. You want to do, before you do anything else, you want to go to ChristmasMountainTrees.com and just really, just look at the pictures of this place. It just is phenomenal. And they don't do it justice. But it's a third-generation family farm. Been there since 1942, and really, it's just a great show. It's just impossibly American in the way that it all came together. But it's true. 1942, the grandfather started going up to Mount Hood. He would actually cut down trees by hand at Mount Hood, bring them back, and then sell them in Portland. That's the grandfather in 1942. Now, whatever that is, 68 years later, you've got his grandson Troy and his wife Jennifer, and they run ChristmasMountainTrees.com. It's a family farm. It's a year-round family farm operation going into their fourth generation. By the way, I should say this, and this is absolutely true. This is Troy's wife, Jennifer, who emailed when I said that, hey, Don and I are going to be going there on Saturday the 4th. If listeners want to come out, we'll get the times and everything posted for that. This is from Jennifer, who is the co-operator of Christmas Mountain Trees. She says, Rick, Troy says to mention that we could even accommodate your plethora of bitches. I did not get to hear that show, but Troy says it was one of the most hilarious things he's heard in a while. So there you go. But you can go there, and it's just an experience. It really is. It's not just the tree. It is an entire day of taking something that often exists only in your imagination or in a movie or on television. It is the classic, romantic Christmas experience that, especially if you have kids, family, and something that, no lie, they're gonna think about and they're going to remember every Christmas from now on. It really will be the Christmas against which all others are measured. And I'm just saying that. So you go there and you're going to see what I'm talking about. You pick out the tree from among the 85,000 that they have, and then they'll take the excess needles off, they'll wrap it up, put it in your vehicle, and you are good to go home. In the meantime, you warm yourself by the fire, you have the cup of hot cider, you're going to be good to go. So Dawn Taylor and I are going to be there this coming Saturday the 4th. More details on that as they are posted at rickemerson.com. That is rickemerson.com. In the meantime, you go to christmasmountaintrees.com to find out more. Mr. Eric Snyder, you can find out more about him at ericdsnyder.com, and he also writes for film.com and cinematical.com. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We want to thank Aaron Duran for joining us today as part of the Week in Geek. Aaron Duran from geekinthecity.com. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Zach Whedon and also Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. As always, the Rick Emerson radio program comes to you from high above the Milkpacking District here in the heart of beautiful Southeast Portland, Oregon, from the Emerson News Network building. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. After a brief musical interlude, an encore of today's Legion of News program, followed by an encore of this very fine radio show, and the Rick Emerson show made possible by a generous grant from y'all today. As always, it is Monday, November 29th, 2010, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. As always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See y'all tomorrow. Bye now.